everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Tetracast. This is RPG Site's weekly podcast where we get the site staff together to talk about our favorite genre of video games. I'm your host. My name is Brian Vitale. Joining me, we've got Josh Torres.
Hi.
Adam Vitale.
Hello.
Chow Min Wu.
How's it going?
James Galizio.
Hey, folks.
And joining us just for the start here to go over a few special topics with us, we have Alex Donaldson.
Hello. Hi.
Hi, Alex. Glad to have you join us for a regular weekly episode, because obviously we haven't had you in a recording since the very long Game of the Year episode. So good to have you here. We know that there's a time zone difference between most of us here in North America and you over in the UK.
Yeah, it's challenging. I was just saying to background for listeners, right? But I was just saying to you guys, it just so happens the time that you always regularly record is always bedtime for my child. So I have to get out of bedtime duty in order to come, but I've managed to sneak away for at least some of it today because I've played some stuff that I think is pretty relevant at the minute.
Right. So, Alex, we've been talking with this year's episodes of the podcast so far, how February was going to be the start of basically a very busy set of months for us. And this week, we've got two major topics, of course. And the reason why we have you here is because you can speak to both of those. We have, of course, the embargo release for Avowed. It's available for, you know, early purchasers and then fully releases within a few days of this recording. And then, of course, we've got the open network test or beta test. I forget the language we're using for Elden Ring Night Rain, which was kind of like that big surprise announcement from late last year that none of us were expecting. And you can speak to both of those. We'll probably straddle both conversations here in our games talk section. We'll talk a little bit of Avowed. We'll talk a little bit of Elden Ring Night Rain. And then we'll go into further detail into, you know, the other news from the state of play and things later into the podcast once you have to step out. So between these two topics, since Alex, you can speak to both of these, I'll kind of let you take the mantle of which one you'd rather speak to first. Of course, one has the review up on the site with some guides, and then Night Rain, we've got a few preview, I think, impressions pieces up on the site. And then I know that both you and Josh have been putting time into that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess let's start with Night Rain, because I guess that's not out. And
right.
Yeah, so obviously the closed beta is on now, but I went out to a preview event that Bandai Namco had and spoke to the director of the game 2 weeks ago, something like that. I mean, God, the time has been going so right. Quick, because like you say, February's so crazy busy. So I played a couple of matches on the closed network test yesterday, but I have had a fair bit more experience. Well, I've probably had at this stage still more experience than anyone who's played in the network test, because basically at this event they gave us a very short sort of PowerPoint presentation explaining how to play and stuff, which also meant we went in with a lot more knowledge than some people. Like, I actually think the closed network test is a strangely bad idea on Namco's part. Obviously, they need to test the servers, so it's not a bad idea in that sense. But I've seen a lot of people going, like, I don't understand how abilities work at all, because it's not explained at all, really, in what they presented.
Coming in with Elden Ring knowledge doesn't carry you? Is it different enough?
It doesn't. Or... well, it helps a little bit, but the ability system, which we'll come onto, is completely different. And the only way to really get to grips with it in the beta is to sort of, in Roundtable Hold, which is like your hub from which you get into matches, there's now a sort of training area, and you can go there. But because it's the weird combination of how they've done things, because this beta is only on for like 3 hours at a time, I think people are getting on and going, I haven't got much time, shit, I need to play. So they're just jumping straight into matches and not knowing what they're doing.
I like organically, because I got to play one of the sessions in full for the 3 hours, and I organically started to understand that, like, maybe within like my second, like the middle of my second match. But it's kind of weird, because as you were talking about this, the Roundtable Hub section, which is, you know, a location from Elden Ring, there's like the training ground section where you can like test out loadouts and like, you know, stuff like that, and kind of mess with it. But it's not really intuitive. And then there's like another section of that hub area where there's like a stack of books on a table, almost like a tutorial hub, but it won't ever tell you that it's there. You have to like see, like kind of explore around and not matchmake to like find it and say, oh, okay, this is where like all the previous tutorial things are there. And the only other way you kind of get a sense of like what each, like the distinct characters can do, because you're not making your own character. You're selecting one from four characters that are available, in that beta is like when you hover, there's like a character section before you matchmake. There's like a separate character section that like you can click on that character and like highlight them and show like what their abilities are. This is basically like it shows their ability names and like a very brief description of what it does, but never really. You won't really know what it does until like you press that button in the game, and even then you have to remember that it's a distinct button combination that you don't ever use in like the original Elden Ring game. It's like triangle plus R2 and triangle plus L2 for your two abilities. One is like a low cooldown one, and one is sort of like your quote unquote ultimate one that's on a longer cooldown.
This is what I mean though. It's just like the format that we had at the event. Yeah. We at least got stuff explained. Just,
right.
We got the format of the game explained to us. We got Merc, which is the currency, explained to us. All this stuff. Everyone else just been thrown in. So I don't think it necessarily helps the game to make the best impression. And I think the other element that really helped us compared to, I think, what's probably the case for most people is being matched with, rather not against, random people is definitely not. This is a game that they want you to do a lot of communication.
100%, yeah.
Playing it in a room with three other people where our headsets were wired together so we could hear each other, we could discuss.
Yes.
It's an absolute must, I think. I mean, obviously, you know, I think it's going to be best played with friends where you pre-organize, we're going to play at this time, da, 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 da. But I think it'll be fine with matchmaking as well, but it'll be a game where it's like one of those ones where you're going to want to have a headset on even with
and even at the moment that's for the closed network test, like they did disable the multiplayer in the closed network test because they're having problems with it. So that's like kind of just adding on, like you're forced to play with pubs at the closed network test at the moment.
Yeah, I did see quite a few people talking about how they were kind of underwhelmed with the network test specifically because it's like, oh, I don't think I can trust playing with like random people, and that's fine. But it definitely always to me seemed like the sort of game where you're going to probably want to have other people you know you're going to be playing with.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me explain the flow of when I was playing it with people, right? So I played it with the same three people for 7 hours. So we really got a handle.
Now, just to be clear, it's three people total, right? You and two others?
Yes.
Yeah.
Or is it four people? Okay, you and two others. Okay,
go ahead. No, you can play it with one person solo, and you're on your own. There's no AI. Or you can play it with three people. That's it.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting
choice. There's no two
player. That's what they balance towards. Yeah. However, when I spoke to the director, he did say, he basically said in that very classically Japanese developer way, we didn't realize there would be this much interest in two player. We will look into it. I don't know how you don't realize that, but okay. But it's something they've said they might look into post launch. And I think it will just require rebalancing because obviously the nature of how hard the combat is, and they don't want to just do a multiplier of making enemies weaker. They want to actually rebalance it for the number of players. So it's balanced for three and it's balanced for one. Anyway, so yeah, the flow really becomes, obviously you drop into this island and the string of fire is constantly coming in, and basically there's the daytime, the nighttime. In the daytime, your job is to run around and basically level up and gather equipment or upgrades, various things to make yourself more powerful, all the while the ring of fire is closing in. And as the ring of fire closes in, basically what it's going to do at the end is limit you to one tiny area, and that area becomes the boss arena when you get to nighttime. And if you're playing with people who you're actually communicating with, it becomes fascinating because there's two different types of loot in this game. So there's communal loot, like when you open a chest or something, and the communal loot appears in the game world for everyone, and the first person to pick it up gets it, so you can be selfish or you can be nice. But then there's individual loot, and you get this by beating bosses or completing certain feats. It sort of spawns from an orb in the air, and when you interact with the orb, it gives you a very roguelike, a choice between three different random things. And that is where a lot of the communication comes in, not just battle strategy and where are we going. And those things are easily communicated actually via the UI, where they've got a great little system on the map where everyone can place a waypoint, but if two people place the same waypoint, it highlights that one to say there's a consensus that people want to go to this place. Really good, really smart design. But the weapon stuff, there's no like easy way to communicate that without voice. and so in a good situation. So I was in this playthrough, I was playing as the mage character, as the recluse. And what we quickly realized was the mage's towers that you find in Elden Ring, where you have to solve a little puzzle to break the seal and get into them. One, we figured out all the ways that those puzzles appeared, at least in this variation of the map. We had the same content that was in the closed, that's in the network test. But two, we realized that those places are pretty much guaranteed to spawn good mage gear. What gear you get is random, but they're guaranteed you're going to get something half decent for mages. So we would, as a trio, climb this tower, and all three of us would interact with the individual loot at the top, which, you know, so we'd all get one item each. But the other two guys would communicate with me what mage items they had available, because they weren't playing mages. They would pick them up and then drop them so I could get them. So this then becomes this strategy of this me of me building my mage build, where the other people are saying to me, okay, I've got this this that's got Comet Azure on it. I was like, I want that. I've got this, which gives you 10% FP, minus 10% FP usage as a bonus. I was like, I want that. So they would actually take that as their loot and then drop it for me. And similarly, when we defeated a boss, if I got a giant axe or a greatsword or something that I was definitely not going to use, I would communicate to them that I had that and drop it for them. And so that sort of stuff, when you get into the character RPG building, especially when you have to do it all so fast, is where the teamwork is really, really going to come into play. And I think it's excellently executed.
Yeah, the communal loot kind of reminds me of really good.
It kind of reminds me of the original rendition of Crystal Chronicles on the GameCube, where you'd have that collection wheel at the end of a dungeon, and it'd be like, no, don't get that artifact. That's perfect for me, or whatever. And of course, this is all Game Boy Advance Link Cables couch co-op. So it's you shouting at your friends in middle school, at least for me. that sort of thing.
It's totally that to some degree. I think it's excellent. I really like the sense of panic, where you realize, oh god, the circle kind of moves slowly, and then it says the rains begin to gather, and then the circle speeds up massively and gets to a medium-sized circle, and then it stays at the medium-sized circle for a while, and then the rain gets heavier, and then the circle gets really quick, and that's when you've got to sort of book it to the boss arena.
Yeah, but when you're in the bad zone, like outside of that, like your health constantly like drains, and like it's at a speed where you're like, okay, I really need to move to get back into like the quote unquote good zone. You never want to be in that level whatsoever.
There's a lot of cool strategy around that as well. So like, for instance, if you're fighting a boss and you don't quite defeat it in time, and the fire comes in, you can then run away from that boss. But if you survive the night to the next day, enemy health does not change from day to day, at least on the bosses.
Yeah, interesting.
So if you half kill a dragon on day one, and then you have to flee because the fire's coming in, which happened to us on a couple of occasions, you can then, again, this is where the communication comes in, of a player going, as soon as the night one boss is down, going, right, as soon as day two starts, let's book it back to that boss and finish him. And because you'll be able to do it super quick. And all that is super, super interesting. I think the strategy is really interesting. As I sort of say in the preview on the site, which I recommend people read, I think it's probably going to live or die based on the content that's available and the content, like whatever's available in the base package, and then the update cadence. I think they've got to keep updating this map and offering different maps. I think it's very telling that this map is like the Limgrave biome from Elden Ring. And so I look at it and I'm like, again, the director of the game was very clear when I spoke to him. He was like, we are not a live service game. People should not expect a live service cadence to our updates. Totally fair. Good on him for saying it out loud so clearly. But I would not be surprised if we go to this game. When does this game come out? May. Yeah. So I wouldn't be surprised if we go to Summer Games Fest in June and they announce their first new map, which will be like the Caelid biome, and then they'll do the Lernia of the Lakes biome, and then they'll do the Mountaintops of the Giants biome, and so on and so forth. Because within Elden Ring, I think, you've got 8 different biomes, maybe more if you count in the underground. So clearly they can do multiple variations on this. And I think the game will live or die based on on how they update it. But if they update it a lot and they keep the money, you know, the money situation, the monetization reasonable, this is something I can see myself playing for years.
I don't know. It really depends, I guess, on what's the content at day one, like how much they have there at day one, because obviously with the network test, it's very limited. Like you have like basically two seeds where like your first boss, night boss, will be like either the centipede demon or the demi-human duo, and then so forth. You might have.
Well, that's based on the Night Lord, to be clear. So basically there are eight Night Lords, and each Night Lord has a selection of deputies, as in, you know, lower end bosses that they can pick from, and the map actually adjusts as well some of it on a level of randomness and some of it based on which Night Lord you choose. So in the beta, people aren't seeing very much variation because there's only one Night Lord. But theoretically, if you pick the second Night Lord, the third Night Lord, it's going to be different pools of bosses on night one and night two. There might be deeper pools because this is the first Night Lord, so it makes sense that maybe they've only got two for each day. Whereas the fifth Night Lord might have six different potential bosses or whatever. I don't know. Yeah. This is me speculating.
Right.
And obviously, the map also will change. So if you go and look at the screenshots for this game, for instance, the screenshots of like an underground area that's all lava, which that is not in the map.
Yeah.
That is in the beta. And that's not a completely different map, though. The only map the game ships with is this Limveld map. So that tells us that the map's going to change quite a bit as well over the course of the eight Night Lords. The question is, what happens after that?
Yeah.
I think. I do think for 40 quid or 40 bucks, whatever it is, the amount of content in there seems to be fine. Like, you know, admittedly, there are going to be people in the beta who get a lucky run and smash the first Night Lord pretty quick. But like, I played for 7 hours. We only beat the Night Lord once. So, you know, you based on that, you can sort of extrapolate and say, well, maybe that means then you probably can be looking at like a 40, 50 hour experience to do all the Night Lords once, which is the base game, which I think is perfectly reasonable. But I just question, with a multiplayer game like this, what else there's going to be beyond that after the fact.
I feel like it'll run into, oddly enough, the Outriders problem, where people expect it to be a live service, even though people, they'll convey time and time again that it's not a live service game. The modern audience, by and large, will expect it to be one. And then
But I think this is From Software, and I think people know what they're about, and wouldn't expect a live service game from them.
Yeah,
and it's like, how do you think about it? Is Monster Hunter a live service? Like, because
I was actually going to bring up Monster Hunter as like occupying that sliver of space between a packaged full release and a live service game. There's a very small gap potentially in that Monster Hunter-ish update cadence.
Not quite live service, but
approaching that.
Yeah.
I don't think they'll do a Monster Hunter style full on expansion. Maybe I'll be wrong, but I don't know. But it doesn't feel like the right sort of structure to do an expansion in that way. So I do think it'll be like smaller content drops where you do a map for £10 or £15. And also, we already know from like the deluxe edition, like the deluxe edition includes, it straight up says new bosses and new characters, because you get eight different characters you can play as.
I wonder if those updates are like free updates, though, like how, you know, when content title updates for Monster Hunter, you get those new monsters for free. You don't pay to.
I think there will totally be a mix. I think it will be, some of it will be paid and some of it will be free.
I hope it's not paid. They need to have like a smarter strategy for continued monetization instead of like locking like actual gameplay content real money. I think that would be not a great move. Because it reminds me of like how fighting game DLC used to, or not fighting game DLC, like Call of Duty maps used to work, but they had DLC maps that divided the community about those who only played for the base game and those who had the base game plus the DLC. So you divided up the multiplayer community even more, because some people had ones that had all the maps and some people only play the base maps.
What they could do is they could take an approach kind of similar to how like the Vermintide and Darktide games work, where it's like, as long as someone in the group has a DLC, it can get added to the pool.
They can do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll be interesting, but I'm just interested in how they continue it. I think what's there at launch is clearly going to be worth the price of entry, which is fine by me.
I think people would people will be surprised for people who haven't played the network test or haven't seen it yet. They're going to be very, very surprised like how quick that your character can move. There's a lot of mobility options, and when you sprint in that game for the first time, you'll be like, "Oh my god, this is so much faster than Elden Ring movement."
It feels nothing. It feels nothing like Elden Ring in many ways. And like,
yeah, you like an arcade edition, like a rainbow edition.
I've already seen people wilder the character that has the grappling hook. I've already been seeing people using that grappling hook and moving around like Bionic Commando in Marvel vs. Capcom. Yeah. Like, it's crazy.
I think Wilder and Recluse were my favorite characters to play as. I really
Recluse
like
the is great.
Yeah. Because Recluse has like a whole like magic mechanic that mixing the magical cocktail. Like, that mechanic is really cool. I like that.
Well, it's fascinating to me. We've got 8 different characters and more DLC characters already planned, because it tells us we're going to get them if you buy the deluxe edition. Each one of those is going to have a completely unique ability, and based on how unique the abilities of the characters we already know about are, that sounds pretty rad to me.
Yeah. And for people who don't know, also when you're leveling up, like, and level ups are, you smash the button to level up, and then all the stat ups are automatic. You're not picking like which stat to level up, and everything is just like on the go. Just if you have the souls, immediate level up and move on. So like 2 seconds. So it's I think my favorite one of my favorite things about it is like some of the bosses are like I said, like remixed rainbow editions, like was it Margit from Elden Ring, like the big first major boss that people have trouble with. Like, that boss is in the beta, but has like some expanded remixed move set where you'll see some moves that he used to use, but it's like expanded like a bigger area, or the way that it's executed is much more in a bigger, grander scope, or just like entire like new moves. Like, it has like a new like almost like a Rivers of Blood type move, like EI slash sort of thing going on. I'm like that's really exciting for me, because we know that this will have like, you know, mainline souls bosses in this game, but they're also willing to give that Souls legacy boss like new moves, or maybe remixed moves that, like, it's like you remember seeing that but not exactly like that sort of thing. And this, it has the capability and potential of like seeing these for the first time just the first encounter is really, I don't know, it's exciting for me as like someone who's like played all the Souls games.
This is the last thing as well that I would say. I think the content reuse as it's formatted is fine, to be honest.
Yeah.
Like, and the map is really interesting, because obviously you've got the enemies and that's obvious, and it's like the trash mobs haven't really changed much, but that's fine because they don't really matter. The bosses are really interesting in terms of they've all been rebalanced and given new moves and changed and stuff in order to rebalance them for this multiplayer setting, and I think that's really interesting. Some of it is like, I did see people laughing that like the centipede demon from Dark Souls straight up even has the same music.
Like, yeah.
But yeah, the moveset has been changed and stuff. Absolutely. Like that. So it is different. And I actually think the way they've done the world is really interesting, because the world is like, when we got the trailer at the Game Awards, it sort of looked like this took place in Limgrave from the main game. But actually what it is it's almost like, clearly their engine must work in a way where that open world is built out of chunks.
Like,
and so although there are, so I caught myself at one point, I was running up a hill, and I was like, hang on, like the layout of this hill, the layout of the barricades on this hill, I was like, this is Stormhill from the main game, but it's in a completely different place, it leads to a completely different place, it's a completely different terminus, it's just different. Similarly, like Kenneth Height's castle from the main game can also be there. So you end up with this sort of thing of like, it's almost like the world has been pulled apart and glued back together in different ways. And some of it is all new as well. It's really, really interesting. So I think the content reuse stuff, so as people will call it, is actually fine in the context in which they've done it. It doesn't feel lazy. It doesn't feel sneaky. It just feels economical.
Yeah, it feels, it helps. It's like, it's not a full price game. It's like the standard price of the game is $40. So I think more people will be forgiving about that, because it's not, you're not, they're not charging $70 for the game.
100%, yeah.
It's just I'm way more interested now that I've actually got hands-on time with it and played it. I was like very iffy. I always like when FromSoft does experimental stuff, but of course sometimes they like to be too experimental at times, of going like, what the hell am I playing? But after spending some time with it, I'm like, I'm really interested in what that was.
Yeah.
I went into it not, I thought it wasn't going to be for me at all, and now I cannot wait. And that's probably the best thing I can say.
Yeah.
So, Alex, since we do have you for a limited time, I was going to ask if you wanted to speak to Avowed, because you had covered Avowed for VG247, and then I had covered Avowed for here at RPG Site. So I've read both of our reviews. Of course, I wrote one of them. But since you have limited time, just your thoughts on Avowed, basically, you scored it very well and seem to think very highly of it. So here's a chance to kind of speak to it.
Yeah, I think I liked it a bit more than you, to be fair. But I think it's really good. I guess I would. It's a less complicated game. It's a blissfully uncomplicated game in general. It's easy to talk about. It's easy to think about. Whereas with Elden Ring, we had to have so many explanations. And I guess what I would say is, I'd sum it up a few ways. The first thing I'd say is, in terms of being I hate to make comparisons, but that's where we're at. In terms of being a sequel or spin-off, whatever you want to say, to a CRPG that finds a way to respect the CRPG roots while making an action-adventure game that is far more, an action-adventure RPG that is far more approachable, this absolutely rips Dragon Age the Veilguard to pieces. That's the first thing I'd say. And it's not that Veilguard's a bad game, Veilguard's fine, but this is just in a completely other class in terms of threading that needle. Second thing I'd say is, it's a very different game to Elder Scrolls. Like, it doesn't have that world permanence and that world reactivity as Elder Scrolls. You're not going to be putting any buckets on anyone's heads. You know, you're not picking up every single item of fruit you see and things like that.
You can't pick up wheels of cheese and set them behind the counter or whatever.
Exactly. There's a lot of the world that's non-interactive. However, I can't explain it. It's a vibe, but I just sort of, when I was really into this, I was getting the same sort of vibes as just broad vibes that I got when I played Oblivion back in the day, which is a really big compliment because that's my favorite Elder Scrolls game. But also, it's sort of in a way that fits more into my grown-up life now. You know, when Oblivion came out, I was a teenager with loads of time on my hands. And now I've got, you know, a kid and stuff, and it's harder. And so the fact this is like, it's got that Dragon Age Inquisition structure of, rather than an open world, it's got multiple large but reasonably sized zones, so you can focus on clearing one zone out and doing everything there is to do in one zone if you want, then move on, or you can move on, then come back, and so on and so forth.
Just due to release proximity, I saw some comparisons between Avowed and Kingdom Come Deliverance, but I feel like those two games, while they're both Western RPGs, are really different in terms of structure, scope, style, practically everything.
And I think a lot of those comparisons are also in bad faith. They're trying to do different things. So when Kingdom Come makes a mini game out of blacksmithing a sword, and then everything in Avowed is a little bit more arcadey in terms of, like, you just slap a few twigs on a weapon to upgrade it. Like, they're just trying to do different things. So
that's correct.
Yeah, go ahead.
But let's put it another way. Like, basically, where the comparison sticks is Kingdom Come is like a gritty, down-to-earth vision of an RPG where it really aims to sort of make you feel that world and really aims to present a realistic, joined-up world. Avowed is a game, and they're both good games. Avowed is a game that is a video game-ass video game, and it's not remotely ashamed of it. And that's actually, I think, in the RPG space, really quite refreshing. Because I think in the RPG space, especially with big Western RPGs, people are always chasing that immersion and really making you feel like you're in, you know. And so you end up going down a path where the only thing you can do is be quite serious. And this, and maybe that's why I get that Oblivion energy, because I feel like that's something that even changed a little bit from Oblivion to Skyrim. Some of the ridiculousness sort of ebbed off a bit for Skyrim. It's just got a nice heart. And when I say that, it's breezy. But when I say that, it doesn't mean that it doesn't have consequence, and it doesn't mean that the story isn't good, and the story branches and the choices aren't quite meaningful and don't make you stop and think, because they do. But it's sort of just got that energy of, In Kingdom Come, it would feel a bit silly to just be clambering around everywhere looking for chests. Chests are a great example, right? In the sense that I think this is exactly the sort of thing that tells you what sort of game Avowed is. Loot chests make a noise. They make like a little tinkling magic Tinkerbell sprinkle of fairy dust sound.
To notify you that they're there. You're near a chest, yeah, so find it.
Yeah. So you will hear that in your peripheral, you know, audio and go, oh. And then you'll start looking around for it, and then you're searching behind waterfalls and stuff, and there's loot and little nooks and crannies everywhere in this game.
And it's not immersive at all in that way, where it's like, who would actually put this pair of gloves in a chest in a cave under a waterfall? Like,
no, but it just reminds me of a golden age. It just reminds me of a golden age of video games where they weren't afraid to be video games as much, and I really enjoy it.
The two games that I had played most recently, the two similar-ish games that I had played most recently before going to Avowed, is early in January, I rebooted up Starfield to kind of wrap up some achievements and things, and I played Kingdom Come 1. The main difference that I feel with both those games and Avowed is that they have large playable spaces, but you spend a lot of time running from place to place or on a horse or on a ship or whatever. So you have like nodes of interest, whether it's a city or a town or dungeon or a point of interest or a space station, whatever, but then you have to traverse between them, and sometimes there's some gameplay, like you might have, you know, you're fast traveling in Kingdom Come and there's some sort of event that you run into, or you have to fight off a few space pirates in Starfield. But in Avowed, the maps, despite their size, are really quite dense. If there's any sliver of fog of war left on the map, there's probably a cave and a treasure hidden there, or a quest that you haven't come across. Like, you're very rarely just moving from point to point. The whole map is like, is kind of like the play space in that way. It's not nodes on a map that you look at your compass at the top of the screen and say, oh, I got to go to that icon because that's where the thing is. Everywhere is where the stuff is. And that's not what I was expecting from an Obsidian game. I don't think there's any other Obsidian game that had that as its primary strength, the exploration. This game got a lot of comparisons to, like, The Outer Worlds. And The Outer Worlds, I'll be honest, I don't have a lot of strong memories of. It was kind of a very, like, play-and-forget sort of game to me. But I remember the hostile planet, Mantis, I forget what it was called, was just, like, a large playable dungeon with not a lot in it. Like, you would come across, like, some enemies, but you would just, there wasn't anything interesting there. But when I play through Avowed, especially the first two zones, I think the later two zones aren't as good, but they're still pretty good. Just there's stuff everywhere. And by stuff, I mean, here's an optional dungeon. Here's a quest location. Here's a city. Here's something for you to find that's related to a treasure map or a bounty or something like that. And that's kind of, I think, what I walked away from Avowed feeling most strong about was... And also, there's a lot of verticality. I wasn't expecting to platform as much. And the game asks you all the time to, like, think vertically. Like, can you jump or dive or go under this or go around this? And I wasn't expecting that sort of first-person... I played it in first-person. First-person platformer to be as prevalent as it was in this game. And I totally thought that it fit.
Yeah, I think it's really lovely. I think they did a really, really good job. And I was someone who... Interesting, because I sort of I'm always if you give me the choice, I love fantasy, but I'll always take science fiction over fantasy. You know, I'll take Cyberpunk over The Witcher, I'll take Mass Effect over Dragon Age, and so on and so forth. But Outer Worlds sort of I bounced off it a little bit, but this has absolutely grabbed me in a way that didn't. And despite my predilections usually being the other way around. And I can't quite explain why that is, but it is quite different to that game. It must be.
I kind of described it like the two Pillars games. And when I played this, I had played and enjoyed both Pillars games, but it's been, what, 6 years since Deadfire, 7 years? So it's not like I have it fresh in my mind. I remember the broad strokes. I remember my favorite party members. I remember the premise, but it's not like I have it committed to memory. But then the way that Avowed approaches its references to the Pillars games is that it allows you to kind of infer what happened. It doesn't expect that you know the details. If you don't know, it'll give you enough foundation to glean the gaps to understand at least the high concepts. But it's not like quizzing you on do you know what happened? Do you know when this takes place? Do you know how long ago those events were? It really doesn't. But of course, I can't replay the game with my memory completely flushed. So I kind of left that as a question in my review. It's just that I don't know someone who hadn't played those games, because Avowed is clearly going for like a much like broader audience. But it doesn't discount those events either. It's like, this takes place in the same world and in the same time period. They could have easily said, oh, this takes place 200 years or later, and those are long gone events. Like, no, this takes place, I believe, 3 years after Deadfire. So if you had played and enjoyed those games, you feel like you're returning home in a way. But also, those games, Pillars 1 especially, and Pillars 2 somewhat, are often criticized, and I don't disagree, for being like dry, verbose. They don't latch onto you the same way like an action set piece does in like a Mass Effect or a Dragon Age or a Witcher. They're a little bit more slower burns. There's a lot more jargon, and a lot of people bounce off that. And I think Avowed has some of that same DNA, but I found myself really compelled by it. It wasn't an action movie. I kind of enjoyed it like you would like a documentary series. And I know that sounds very boring, push your glasses up on your face, but just everything is so cohesive. The characters feel like they live in the world. The world itself feels lived in. It doesn't feel like it doesn't feel like this is here for the sake of being something for the player to have to wrangle with, in terms of like, here's the decision, and one decision's clearly goody two shoes, and one decision's clearly you're an asshole. The decisions actually make you think, like, what is the right option here? What is going to be the consequence of me making this choice? And sometimes I think the game comes through really strongly on conveying those. And there's a few quests that I think are a little bit weaker. But on that front, I think one of the things I enjoyed that actually took me a little bit to calibrate myself to was, you might have a quest, and a quest might have a simple outcome. But then after the quest is cleared out of your log, very boilerplate, well-worn, you did a quest, you did a thing, you got a reward, you put it in your pocket and you move on, you'll encounter those same NPCs or characters later in the game. They aren't marked, they aren't flagged. It doesn't say, hey, catch up with this person here in this place, but you'll run into them and they'll reference, you know, oh, you helped me back there. Or yeah, you tracked down the land deed and we moved to this town and here we are now. Thank you. And they might give you something for it. And it's not marked on your quest log. It's not gamified in that way. But it makes the game, it makes the world feel lived in. Like, you did something for a person. You got your player protagonist kind of, yeah, I have the authority to do these sorts of things. But then the game keeps spinning. The world keeps turning, so to speak, whether or not you're involved past that point. And that, I think, was a real strong strength of the game that made its world building feel really cohesive in that sense. And I put a few examples of that in my review to try to illustrate what I mean by that.
I have a question for both of you, and it's kind of a dumb question. The pillars 1 and 2 have like as many bears as Avowed apparently does.
It's been a long time, but no, I don't. That is one weakness of Avowed, is enemy density. It's not like I've seen worse, but I've seen better. There are a lot of bears. There are a lot of Zarups.
I'm just asking because I'm like, most, just like, yeah, they seem to have like, bears seem to be common in this universe, and I'm like, I don't know why the bears are so prolific apparently in this game based on what people are saying. I think it's more amusing than it is.
Yeah, it is, because bears are cool.
Bears are
cool. Yeah, I think it is kind of rule of cool. But yeah, the enemy density is not good enough. Like, I didn't really feel that, but it is like, you do fight a lot of Zarups, which are like the anthropomorphized lizards. You do fight a lot of beetles, giant, like, you know, dung beetles or whatever. And it's one of those things where I think the combat, and this is one thing I'm interested in hearing Alex's thoughts before he has to step out, I wasn't expecting first person combat to feel as good as it does, but it does. But also, I played as a mage, and I don't know if your perspective is much different, for better or worse, if you play as a different like sort of a player. One thing I did notice, so basically you have there are no set classes, which is a big departure from the Pillar series, where the Pillars, you pick like an origin and a class, very traditional in that sense. But here you have like a wizard skill tree, a fighter skill tree, and ranger skill tree, and you can mix and match, which is fun for like build craft or whatever. I did notice that the fighter skill tree is full of a lot of passives. So it's a lot of like bonuses that you just stock up, and you take less damage, you move quicker, you are more resistant to status accumulations, things like that. Where all the wizard skill tree is, there's some passives, like your wand charge attack does more damage or bounces between enemies, but it's a lot more active in terms of, like, you can now cast this spell, you can now use this level of grimoire, which has its own spells or things like that. So I do wonder if people's takeaway on the combat is really going to depend on what sort of build they end up with. But I have seen a lot of people that, even playing physical classes, really enjoying it. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I do think the physical class stuff, I don't think it's as tight as playing a ranged class, but I think it's way better than people have come to expect from an Elder Scrolls or something. And I think it's really good about, again, the enemy variety is limited, but also there's a joy to that. Again, it's video gamey, but it's like, so yes, you've got Zalrips and you've got skeletons and you've got various types of humans and you've got, I forget what they're called, but the sort of infected people with the fungus. Who've got the Dream Scourge.
Dream Scourge, yeah.
But I forget what they call them.
They're basically zombies.
They've got Dream Scourge, but there's a name for them.
Oh, okay.
There's a name for them, but I forget what it is. But basically, in a lot of cases, it's like you look at skeletons and Zalrips, for instance, and humans, they all have a priest enemy, who heals the others. So it's like, if it doesn't really matter what type of enemy it is, if you see such and such priest, you know you've got to kill them first. There's something, again, it's very unashamedly video gamey, and it just leans into the combat. It's almost like, you know, this is going to sound bizarre when I say it, but just roll with me. It's almost like a what if Doom was an RPG sort of attitude to combat. Like, that rhythmic nature of Doom, of the modern Doom games, it is totally there in this, but in a role-playing format. And I think
I actually appreciated how strong the priests are in this game. In general, this game is hard, at least on the normal difficulty, to overlevel. It feels very balanced around you being, maybe not completionist, but thorough. Like, even after kind of really exploring the maps, it's not like I was a god walking amongst mere mortals. Enemies remain challenging. And if you fight, like, a chieftain, but he's got a priest tucked away healing him, he's healing faster than you can deal damage. And it's like, crap, I got to take out the mage first. You know, you got to take out the healer first, like very classic tabletop RPG feel to it, where it's like, It doesn't care how strong you are. If there's a healer in the party, in the enemy party, so to speak, you got to take them out first or you're going to have a tough time.
And hey, no level scaling.
Guild Wars 1 in that for, yeah. And
get your ass kicked.
Right. And there were times where, like, you would do a quest and it's not dynamic scaling. It's certain regions and certain quests will pit you against tougher monsters than others. But you don't know that. Like, the quests don't come in an order in terms of, like, do this one first, this one second. So you might come across where it's like, oh, crap, this bounty has got two skulls on its icon, which means he's very tough. But of course, if you've got a good skill set or consumables or tenacity or whatever, you can still do it. It's not like you're deterred away. Just like, this is going to be a challenge and you're not going to sleepwalk through it. You've got to at least try. I do wonder, though, people that do want to more critical path this game, if they're not interested in exploring, which I think exploring is the best part, I think you'd be missing the charm of the game in that sense. You would feel almost easily, it's hard to overlevel, which might mean that it's easy to remain underleveled. Of course, you can always knock the difficulty down. I think there are ways to accommodate for that. But I do think that I actually preferred a game that had that sort of friction, because in games like Kingdom Come or Starfield or Skyrim, even though it's been several years, if you complete all your optional quests and do all the different sort of faction, eventually nothing can stop you and you sleepwalk your way through it. Where in this game, that is not possible, at least not on normal difficulty. In that sense,
I did see some other reviewers kind of speculating, you know, some people when they play a game for review, they might, you know, they're worried about times and embargoes and they have to beat the game, so they might do more of a critical path and struggle in a game like this, and versus a more, I guess, general playthrough where you might do more side stuff. I know none of us, I think, when we review games, we usually are pretty thorough. But some reviewers might try to stick to the main story and they might have, like, they might come away from the game a bit differently because of the challenge they run into.
And I know this is a very small thing, but Avowed manages to do something that so few RPGs manage to do, is that they make the economy feel like appropriate. You can't afford everything. You will not be able to buy out everything you want from shops, but also you will be able to buy a few nice things, like actually being able to find something that you can sell for decent gold. or really make a decision on, oh, this shop has a really good wand. And actually, there was a wand that I really liked that was available in a shop that was like, it fit my build perfectly. And it's like, but it's going to cost me half my money. Should I get it or not? And I ended up doing it and feeling good about it. Like actually having decision making at shops. I know this sounds very boring, but so many games, it becomes a complete afterthought. You are so loaded, or there is some technique to have so much money that it doesn't even, it's no longer gameplay at that point. Where here it becomes gameplay. When you find a chest in a cave that has two superior broadswords in it, and you're not a sword user, you're still like pumping your fist because you can break them down for materials or sell them for a decent gold. And that's what helps keep exploration feeling meaningful, is that even if you don't find something that suits your build, you might find something that is a resource that you can still make use of in that sense. And so it keeps the exploration, like all the systems of the game end up like complementing each other in that way. It makes all the exploration stay meaningful. It means that you keep looking for ways to improve your gear. There's so much unique gear in this game. It feels arcadey in that way. But if you find like a really good shield in the first map that you really like and it fits your playstyle perfectly, eventually it's going to get outclassed unless you put in resources to like literally tier it up. So whether you find gear that you like early on or not, you're still incentivized to find, you know, explore the maps later in the game, see how materials, upgrade your gear. That way it doesn't fall behind. So you're not taking so much damage when you're attacking enemies. And I just think that, so I'm going to keep harping on that. The exploration, at least compared to something like, again, I'm coming from like Starfield and Outer Worlds, where it wasn't really the strength of those games. And it really is here. And I wasn't expecting that.
I don't know if this is, how do I put this? I played the demo of this game at Gamescom, and even just in that quick vertical slice, a very small portion of the game, it was very obvious, like, oh, this game is going to have a lot of exploration. Like you say, like, it's not just battle corridors or open zones. It's like, you know, figuring out your way through different rooms, and like, you might see, there's a chest over there. How do I get to it? So there's some platforming and whatnot. It's definitely it was very evident just in a Cork demo. Like, oh, this is
the type of game. Yeah, it was funny because I was watching hours from he was streaming about to us, and like to get to like this tome, like a cavern for example, like he kept getting this tutorial, and he was like, why is this tutorial popping up? Because he read that he swam to it. It's like a U-shaped like waterway to get to that tome. And then he went outside, and then like to on top of like the cavern area where he was at, he saw the grate, that popped up. That tutorial says, "Hey, slam this grate to get like down there to this tome that he already swam through beneath it to get to that same area." So it was just like really funny. It's like, why am I getting this tutorial like to slam a grate when there's no grate around here? It's like, oh, it's because it's above me. I could have gone that way instead. It's just like little things like that. It's like it's nice to see that like, hey, there's like, you know, there's alternate ways to get traverse to like the same spot, you know, just little things like that.
And you can like sequence break. I haven't got too much time, but I want to say you can like break quests by mistake because you go exploring and you find quest stuff and sort of puzzle stuff together backwards.
In most cases, the game actually accounts for that really well, which a lot of RPGs, at least some Western RPGs of like 2010s, don't do very well, where a quest person or an early game quest, a character in the first city wants you to find a shipment for her, but you can find the shipment first. Like you can go into the warehouse and be like, what's in here? Oh, I found Juliana's shipment. I have no idea what this is. And then eventually you find her and she's like, do you have my shipment? And you're like, oh, I actually already have it. And the dialogue actually approaches that. And it says like, oh, I actually already found this. And the game allows you to do that. Where on some games, and actually it's Failguard, where it's like, you can't go into this cave until you have the quest that asks you to go into this cave. It's like unnaturally blocked off until you're, quote, supposed to go there. And Avowed avoids that. Now, during the pre-game, the pre-embargo, there were a few quests that didn't work quite right if you encountered the destination before the start point, if that makes sense. But those seem like bugs that they're going to fix, or like maybe not quite bugs, but what's the word? They didn't think of it.
I feel like there's always just kind of in modern games, like there's always someone approaches a quest in some unexpected pattern or way or avenue or whatever. And then they kind of have to like, oh, we have to patch the progression to make sure it works. in this direction oversight, as well as what I was thinking. As well as these other directions.
There was a couple quests that, like, if you did them a certain way, they wouldn't work very well, which is, I think, a few reviews, including mine. The Obsidian games have been notorious for being buggy. This is by far not the worst of them. This game is actually pretty well polished. Like, I didn't end up with any stuck quest logs or progression breaking things, but there were a few things where I did have to, like, reload a save from 10 minutes ago to say, oh, I can't speak to that character first. And I'm not hand-wringing it. Like, I actually did take that into account, but hopefully they address those sorts of things.
This change of topic, this is a bit shallow in comparison, but I also feel like this game is really pretty, and it almost, like, I almost, even if you see screenshots, you almost don't realize it until you're actually, like, sitting down and playing it. Like, wow, this game is actually quite nice.
I remember when it was first revealed, a lot of people looked at the saturated colors and the slightly exaggerated proportions. And of course, some people in very bad faith are like, you know, this is garbage. This is not the realism. This is not the proto Skyrim I wanted. But it's not, again, trying to be proto Skyrim. It's really not a whole lot like Skyrim at all. This Avowed is as similar to Skyrim as Outer Worlds is to Fallout, which is not a lot outside of very surface level, superficial theming.
Yeah.
So it's, if you're looking for Skyrim 2 or whatever, this is not that. And it's not trying to be that. It's not that it comes short in being that. It's that it's not really got that ethos in the first place.
And I'll say one last thing. It's interesting.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because it speaks to what you just said. This is a game that did change path a bit in development, is my understanding. There was a period of time where perhaps it was going to be more Xbox's answer to Elder Scrolls, and then Xbox purchased Elder Scrolls, so it no longer needed to be that, and that meant making a smaller game and making a tighter game perhaps. But what they've, and you can, I think you can tell that if you go back and look at the CG announcement trailer, the vibes are completely different.
I actually recommend, if you are interested in this game but still want to see more, just listener, Min-Max did one of the rapid fire interviews that Game Informer used to do with Carrie Patel, the director. It's actually a pretty good video. It's like 10 minutes long, just kind of answering all this stuff. And I believe she says in one of those quick answers that, or maybe the interviewer asked, like, the game might have had, like, multiplayer thoughts at one point, kind of thing. Like some sort of co-op.
So, yeah, I mean, she told me that when she came on, because I interviewed her a while back, and I don't know if it was for VG247 or RPG site, but there's an interview with me, with her, where she basically does say, yeah, when I came on, it was a very different game, and I came on at the point that we were pivoting. But they've just done a fantastic job, and it proves that sometimes less is more. You don't need to be absolutely enormous. Yeah, I really, really like it.
And it's not a short game. Like, it took me 10 to 15 hours. Now I was going slow and taking notes for guide purposes, but if you're thorough with this game, it's a 50, 60 hour RPG. It's not like a breezy 25. So it's not like, oh, this is some short menial thing. It's like, no, there's a lot there if you really dig into it. Like, I think my ultimate hour count ended up, like, being 85, though that's a little inflated because I'm pausing and reloading to write guides and things. But, like, a thorough playthrough, yeah, 50, 60 hours, I'd imagine. Like, 4 zones, 10 to 15 hours per zone. Plus some other stuff at the end. So. But yeah, thanks, Alex, for being able to jump on to talk about both of these kind of very contemporary things with us. Of course, we've got the Avowed review up on RPG site, and then Alex has his review of Avowed both at 20 VG247, so you can read both of our perspectives on the game on those sites. And we do have a few guides. I did some. And we have a few other contributors who contributed some guides on to RPG site for totem locations, treasure maps, things like that, bounties.
And I'm sure we'll have some more to come over the coming week or so. I'm going to do some and bits and bobs, yeah.
And just, again, to speak to some of the strengths of the game, there are some achievements, I know it sounds silly to speak to, where it asks you to do a quest in a very specific way. Like, you managed to complete this quest by poisoning the quest giver. I'm like, wait, how do you do that? I had no idea you could do that. And then I tried reloading the quest and figuring out how, but there's enough permutations that I couldn't quite figure it out. So I bring that up to say the quests aren't prescribed in that way. At least many of them aren't. They have multiple permutations, and depending on who you speak to, what your background is, what your stats are, they might end up quite a bit differently in terms of both early game, just like sub stuff, and how the game ultimately ends. It's the sort of game where I imagine if you had infinite time, you could play through twice and get quite a bit of a different flavor of the story depending on how you replay through the game, which has always been one of Obsidian's strengths, so I'm not surprised to see it here as well.
All right. Well, it's nice to have you, Alex. It's nice to talk to you about Elden Ring. We're definitely going to talk more about that as the releases, creeps up. Of course, it's nice to hear you what you had to say about Avowed.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. And I'm sure I'll be back on soon because there's a hell of a lot going on at the moment. Yeah. I've just seen someone has already soloed the network test of Elden Ring.
Oh, wow.
I
didn't know that you can play the network test solo. I thought it was like first matchmaking.
People are already doing it. Right, I'm going to head off. But thank you, guys. Have a good night. All right,
thank you.
Thank you, Alex. Well, I think that covers us for the two games talks that we really wanted to get into, which were Avowed and Elden Ring Nightreign. I know we were kind of boundary conditioned there based on Alex's time, but were there any other questions about Avowed that I can speak to before we move on?
No, not really. I think it's
I have one question.
Yeah.
I've had this sentiment before, but it's like, I want to play Avowed, but I haven't played Pillars. So I want to play Pillars, even though I know I don't have to.
Yeah.
Like, I know I don't
have
to.
I think what Avowed does is that early on in Avowed, because it takes place, I believe, 3 years after Deadfire, it starts off with some very Deadfire-specific things. Like, they talk about Yukaizo, which is like the big climax point of Deadfire and the events that happened there, and AFS, as Avowed's own narrative spins up, the previous stuff matters less, which I think is a very natural thing. Like early on, it kind of uses those events to kind of frame your position in the world. Like, here's where we are. Here's what happened in the recent past. Here are the global events, but here are the new events. Here's what's going on. The answer is I really wanted to replay Pillars 1 and 2 before Avowed, but I don't have a time turner. I can't freeze time. So I still have them installed. I reinstalled them on my new PC and I kind of want to poke at them, but I have no idea when I'll get to them. So I know that's a very wishy-washy answer, Adam. I'm sorry. I do think that if you play those two games, you'll enjoy them a lot. But I also do think genuinely that Avowed doesn't need it. But I'm biased because I have not played Avowed without that knowledge. So I can never genuinely know what it's like to go.
They do kind of like to play to poke fun at it too, because I remember there's like an early scroll that my friend picked up, and then like the title of the scroll is like Pillars of Eternity right there.
Yeah.
So that was funny to see. But like you said, like I haven't played Pillars yet, and I have no idea. From what I saw, it seems to be a fun game to just like even watch short. No doubt play. I think it's like really interesting during combat, like the amount of hit stop that you have, because my friend is like a melee build, like a big ass broadsword. So like every time you hit an enemy, like the game does like kind of does like a do full hit stop. It's not that it doesn't detract from the game. It's like it's nice to know that you have like an impactful like hit on an enemy, but it kind of took all of us off guard. It's like, wow, that's a big hit stop whenever you make contact with an enemy.
Yeah, there is a toggle. You can toggle to third person anytime. And to me, it seems functional. I know there's a lot of questions about like how well implemented would the third person be, because a lot of people have to play in third person for their own health.
Yeah.
And the answer is like, I played in first person. I messed with the toggle. It seems very fluid. It seems fine. But I'm also not the right person to speak to it. It's just the U key on my keyboard.
It seems definitely playable and viable to play it, but there is definitely some animations that seem to be like this. This was not primarily designed to be a third person game for first and foremost, but it seems certainly playable if you have trouble with playing games in first person. I think you'll be more than just expect some weird animation interactions at times, because it seems like it's first and foremost first person. But that
and they do have lots of toggles for like head bob and weave and things like that. Right. So for accessibility, a couple other rapid fire things. Even though there's a lot of platforming, they do it very tactfully. There's very limited yellow or white paint. Usually places they have to jump are like indicated by like a hanging rope or like a lantern. Sometimes there's like scuff marks, like someone else has previously climbed up. I guess that's the closest it gets to the white paint. I know the whole white yellow paint thing feels like a meme at this point, to either like it or dislike it. But just letting you know what is there. Yeah. There's not a lot of
things. you remind me, like Elden Ring Nightreign definitely has the white paint, because there will be some like, because it's kind of weird, right? In Elden Ring, there's like big jumps that you fall down on, but there's no fall damage at all in that game. So like you'll be stuck at the bottom of a ravine, and then like you're like, okay, how do I get back up? And because like the game has expanded mobility options where you can like kind of do a second double jump off of like a ledge. So like you can kind of climb up onto things that were way higher than you can in Elden Ring game. But the, like you'll know those platforms because there's white paint off of like the white rock that formation. Okay, to get back up, I just like kind of parkour my way up them. So you reminded me of that. Oh yeah, there is that. But it's okay because you're fighting against like this enclosing arena ring as well, because you need that indicator right away telling you, hey, I need to get up this ravine that I fell down on fast, or where do I go? And having visual indicators of that in that context, like, I don't think it detracts from it. It's like, because you're on a time crunch.
Yeah, and here I think it more serves the like almost puzzle like nature where it's like, there's an item up there on that scaffolding. Can you reason how to get up there? There's no just follow the paint. There it is. It's a little bit more of a puzzle. So yeah, it depends on what the game is going for, et cetera. A few other things. Alex ended up, as we've preached on this podcast before, the score is almost like the least important thing of a review, but of course it's what all the aggregators care about. So Alex ended up scoring Avowed higher than me. Some of the weaknesses I thought were, it's a little dry. I ended up liking it, enjoying it still, but I know there's some people that I could easily see bouncing off of it. There was one quest later in the game that you end up having to make a pretty critical decision that could result in lots of people dying. I kind of wanted to be, quote, like, brave, and I did that. And then you go back to town, and you see, like, caskets everywhere, and I'm trying to speak very generically, and, like, you said that you did a thing that had a very impactful decision. At least that's what you're told. But none of your quests are affected. All of the shops are fine. Like, you don't lose access to any of the shops. All the major NPCs are fine. And it's just a sort of thing where it's like, we promise what you did was impactful. And there's some set dressing to sell that, but it doesn't quite hit that punch. I almost wished it inconvenienced me more. Like, by the way, because you did this, you no longer have access to the weapon shop because they died. Like, things like that. There's a couple of quests where you feel like, regardless of what choice you make, it doesn't really matter. Don't get me wrong. There's some quests that definitely feel the opposite, but there's some where it feels a little bit surface level. That's when I use terms like uneven execution, that's the sort of things I kind of mean, is that some things feel like they had a lot of polish and thought, and some things feel a little bit more like, oh, they just squeezed this in here because they had some, you know, a little bit of an afterthought. I think it kind of covers it. Talked about story, talked about gameplay. Exploration, I think, is the height of it. I think that's kind of the reason to play this game. I guess the last thing is that the story never really feels like, I use the word, it never crests. It kind of crescendos and then just kind of ends. And part of me is like, am I too simple? Am I too basic? Did I need like a big ending set piece? Because there really isn't one. But that doesn't mean it's necessarily bad. It's just kind of like not what I'm conditioned to expect. The game, at least the ending I got, just kind of ended. So I kind of like said, like, I was whelmed. And I might need to stew on that a little bit to see like, what was my long-term thoughts about how it ended. But at the time I wrote the review, I was feeling whelmed, so I kind of took that into account.
We haven't talked about any of the characters at all. I know a lot of people have been companions. I know there's no romance in this game, but how are the companions?
The companions are hard. They're hard to describe because they don't have like, oh, their singular character trait is that this one is forgetful or this one likes pizza. You know what I mean? Like so many games, both Western and Eastern, really kind of give each character like they're one, like, describe this character in one sentence. Oh, it's this. But this game doesn't have that, for better and for worse. It makes it feel like you there's nothing that's immediately endearing about them, other than maybe Kai's voice actor sounds like Garrus or whatever. But you eventually kind of have to, like, that's kind of why I said it feels a little bit like a documentary, or at least like an edutainment game almost, where you kind of have to like talk to characters several times in several contexts to kind of learn what their values are, what they think of you, what they sort of support and what they won't support. Like, I think even some of Obsidian's older games, like Knights of the Republic 2, some characters will like, oh, these characters will clearly like the Paragon options, and these characters will clearly like the Renegade options. And, you know, it's very straight-laced in that way. Where here, it's a lot more foggy and, again, dry. So it's good in some ways and maybe not so good in others. Marius is the dwarf you get. He's a ranger. He's very, like, he has a past that he's not proud of, and he kind of pushes back if you try to ask him about it. So in a lot of ways, he's off-putting, but also not in a way that's like, it's understandable. Where it's like, not everyone, you know, some people like Kai are able to almost choose not to have regrets about what they've done. Kai is, I'm going to get this wording wrong. He's like the amphibious, like Aomawa race. I'm screwing that up. And there's some from the archipelago, and there's some from Rauatai, which is like a, almost like a militaristic conquering nation. And basically he's done things as a Rauataian, like ex-war general. I don't know if he was a general, but ex-Rauataian that he's not proud of, but he's choosing not to have regrets. Like, he did what he thought was right at the moment. And that's kind of like, there's no simple way to describe these characters because they are nuanced. And I'm not necessarily saying that that's better, you know, highbrow or whatever. Sometimes you end up speaking to a character four or five times and you're like, I still don't feel like I know who you are or that I get you. And in some ways that's good. And in some ways it makes it easy to bounce off of in some ways. So I think they're all well voice acted. I do think that having a smaller cast of characters allows them to go a little bit more in depth because there are only four companions and one's like a fighter, one's a ranger, one's a healer, and one's a spellcaster, like offensively. Like it's kind of like they fit the core roles. And if they had a fifth or sixth companion, I don't know like what gameplay role they would plot them into.
Because Mass Effect, the original Mass Effect has six companions, right? And I feel like six is a pretty common number. But then like later Mass Effects had more and more. And I know this isn't BioWare, I know, but you eventually get to the point where like you get a companion character, you like do their like recruitment quest, and then you like shelve them forever.
I will say that is one weakness of Avowed. Very strange is that in the second map, you get literally marked in your journal a companion quest for Kai. And it talks about, you know, a person that he that you learned he was, you know, affectionate of, that he's no longer with, and kind of like needed to like reconcile his, you know, lingering emotions a long time ago, and you kind of help him through that. And then later you get a companion quest from Marius about he was an orphan. He never really like went returned to his village. He kind of left his home nation a long time ago and never looked back and kind of regretted it. Giada and Yahtzee, the other two, don't get companion quests. They get plenty to say. They interface plenty with the main story, but it still feels like a weird omission. And I know it might be gamey to say like, oh, each companion gets one quest, but it still feels like an omission that they don't have one, especially when the other two do.
Are you sure you just didn't miss them?
I've looked at like, because people have like data scraped or whatever to like fill up their fan wikis or whatever. And I haven't seen like, oh, there's a quest log in the data files for them. So the answer is potentially, but I don't think so. And it feels like a weird omission because Kai and Marius both have plenty to say in the story. And in addition to that, you get a very personal quest for them, their companion quest. The other two, you do interface with plenty. It's not like they're underbaked, but they don't get a companion quest. It just feels like a weird omission.
I get what you're saying, or like it's kind of gamey to make sure each character gets their companion quest, and it might feel a little bit rote or formulaic. But yeah, it does seem like kind of unbalanced just at a glance.
Yeah. So they're good characters, but they're hard to describe simply, and almost like I would need to play through again and make different choices to really round them out. So in that sense, I do like them a lot. But they're harder to sell than like the Baldur's Gate 3 characters, which are a lot more immediately appealing. I'll put it that way. But yeah, I have my review up on the site. Obviously go read Alex's review as well. We'll have some guides up. Well, we already do, but we'll probably have some additional ones if you're playing through it. And of course, if you have any comments on the game, you know, comment on our socials in the comments or in our Discord. See what you think about it. Before we go into news section, I did play one other thing very briefly, just yesterday. I don't know if we want to spend 5 minutes on it.
I did play
the first Berserker Kazan demo that released in late January.
You're being Clive.
Yeah, well, he doesn't speak a whole lot, so I didn't get to enjoy a ton of Ben Starr dulcet vocals or whatever. But a couple things. First of all, It is a Souls-like. I can't avoid that term. I'm sorry. Like it would be doing a disservice to avoid that. It's a Souls-like in every sense of the word. In a lot of ways, it feels very classic. You can't jump. There is no mini-map. There is no map. It is level-based, though, so it's not truly Souls-like. It's more
Like Neo-ish.
Neo-like, I suppose.
Yeah.
So the demo is the first two like maps. And I assume in the demo you can't replay them, but there's like certain like collectibles in each map that it actually says like you found all of the, I forget what they are, blahs in this area. So I assume in the full game you can replay them, and there might be like challenges or things like that. I'm not sure. But in the demo you can't, at least I couldn't find a way. My two main takeaways were that it's obvious when I look at the trailers, but for some reason I kind of forgotten. The game kind of has like this, I don't know if technically it's cel-shaded, but it has a cel-shaded, like animated to look more 2D than it is look, which I actually think fits it pretty well. And I wasn't really expecting that. It makes it look really clean. It runs really well, like frame rate wise, you know, no issues with hitching or shader compilation or anything like that. I played it DX11. I didn't try it DX12, but I did not have to think about it just running it. It just ran just fine. And then also the game reminds me of Dark Souls 1 in that it really seems to incentivize blocking over dodging. The block might almost be overpowered. Like, as far as I can tell, the three weapon types that you're allowed, which is either dual wield, greatsword, or spear, you can block like without a shield or anything. But as far as I can tell, blocking just nulls all damage if you block in time. Like, there is no, like, if you block with a sword, you still take chip damage or whatever. As far as I can tell...
Or lose stamina. Do you lose stamina if you block?
You do lose stamina, but there's, like, passives that you can get to lose less stamina on successful block. But, like, I'm not a great action game player. I'm not super skilled, but I managed to, like, tenacity, like, pull it out. Like, I'll die to a boss 20 times, but I'll gladly go a 21st time and then win by the seat of my pants or whatever. So I'm not doing no hit runs in Elden Ring or anything like that. But in this game, like once I learned the boss's attack timing, you just got to press the block button in time and you're fine. It feels way too like it's one of those things where if they balance the full release to make the blocking less powerful, I'll feel like darn, but it's the right move because it's a little bit easy to rely
on. Can you parry if like instant block or something? Or
if you block with good timing, the game calls it something. I don't know. Like I got flash guard, but that's not what it's called.
This is the news case.
Yeah, it's not what it's called, but I forget what it's called. Like in terms, but base you have that, which like to say it on at base level, it kind of takes it chips down their like stamina meter if you block in time. If you block like with poor timing, you still avoid the damage. It's just it hurts your stamina, and you hopefully wasted their stamina just swinging their sword at you or whatever. But eventually you can like I got a passive on dual wielding that if you block with the good timing, you deal chip damage to them if you block in time. So you could defeat an enemy theoretically by just blocking with good timing. Funny. Now it's chip damage, so it would take a long time. And it's a sort of thing where once you wear down their stamina, they kind of stagger and you can do like a heavy critical hit sort of thing. So very, very Souls-like-y in that way. Sorry. I enjoyed it a lot. The story definitely takes a backseat. It feels like the sort of thing where it almost feels like it's a video game adaptation of some larger, more detailed story. Because in the very first two levels, it's very high. Like it only gives you the bare minimum you need to know. You are like a general of some nation. You were accused of treason. They cut your tendons so that you can't fight. And they're like traveling. They're like transporting you to, I believe, a prison. But then some evil spirit like inhabits your body and says, I need to make use of your body. And then basically like the first level is like a conflict between Kazan and the spirit, basically fighting for control of his body. I know that sounds very strange, but that's kind of the premise. And then in the second level, it's kind of like a fight in your mind with the spirit. And it's very like simplistically put where Kazan's like, we don't have to fight. I help you. You help me get revenge, something like that. So they basically like handshake, like sure, we'll work together. Evil spirit, I don't care what you're like. The spirit says something like, "I want to restore Nephilim," and Kazan's like, "Sure, sounds great. As long as you help me get revenge on the people that cut the tendons out of my arms, or whatever." So it's very like goofy in that way. And I think that's all it really needs. I don't need it to be like lore dumps, things like that. And yeah, I enjoyed it. It's a game that I kind of, I don't know why I'm interested in it, but it was fun. It ran very well. It feels a little bit unbalanced. I bet this is a game
where the balanced year, Brian, we're going to be the Kazan heads this year.
Yeah. It feels like the sort of people where I'm not very skilled at action games, but if you are skilled at action games, I could see you playing through this demo and being like, wow, that is cakewalk. It's only got two difficulty modes, easy and normal. I played it on normal, so I wasn't that much of a weenie, but I did struggle on the bosses a few times. I think they each took me like four or five tries. But I could see someone who's really skilled at these sorts of games it needs.
Since I'm a god gamer, I can play that game blindfolded and be fine. Got it.
Probably.
Dance mat too, okay?
Yeah, with a dance mat blindfolded.
And you'll tell them I could do this all day.
But yeah, that was just a little quick thoughts on that demo. Yeah. So
that's something that comes out next month, I believe, right?
Late March. Yeah. March.
That soon, eh?
Wow. It'll be here before you know it. All right. The other thing that's been going on, of course, is we have some features up on the site all about Monster Hunter. Monster Hunter Wilds, of course, which is coming out right at the end of the month. James has put up a feature. We have James has actually put up, I think, a couple features.
Yeah. So basically, there was a slight misunderstanding on Alex's end, where it's like I'd mentioned in the staff chat, it's like, yeah, we got this invite to this final preview event in LA, and I'm doing it. And apparently a freelancer friend of Alex's also did a similar preview event. So it's like, we basically had two separate people going to two separate final preview events at the same time, with the same embargo, putting up two separate previews.
Yeah, and then of course there was also the second beta? They had another beta that they extended slightly because of the PlayStation outage. So I didn't play it, but I think we had a few people obviously on the RPG general chat that did. I think Josh did as well.
I didn't play the open beta, the second open beta. I only played the first one. I'm trying to think of like because we said we would follow up on the Sony outage, but I don't think Sony ever provided like a real concrete reason of why it went down.
Actually
reported after 24 hours. Yep. Okay. So that's all we can tell you. It's like it went down for 24 hours. They didn't give a really a concrete reason, but they did.
After 5 days.
So Capcom extended the open beta to account for that, and also the people who were subscribed to PlayStation Plus got some extra free days because it went down. Of course, people are paying for that service to be up all the time.
So James, did you want to speak to your preview at all, or just let it speak for itself? Because obviously we're only a couple weeks away from launch at this point.
Yeah, the only thing I really want to say is that it, like we said in previous podcasts, it's kind of weird how with the second open beta test, it's based off the same build as the first one, which was already pretty outdated and had performance issues and all that sort of stuff. I can say that based off of the build that I played on a PS5, that I do think that the PS5 version, at least, I wouldn't really worry about performance issues in like the performance mode. It's not a fully locked 60 FPS, but it runs a lot better than, say, like Monster Hunter World did on a base PlayStation 4. So that's good.
Yeah, things are looking kind of rough there, but and obviously a demanding game, but it seems like they've managed to at least tighten the freight ends a little bit right ahead of release.
Yeah, and obviously since then the benchmark tool is released on PC, which is giving people an idea of what the final performance is supposed to be like. And it's a demanding game. One thing I would mention is that even Monster Hunter World was a very CPU demanding game when it came out. And I remember I even mentioned it on Blue Sky. It's like, I'm not saying that the performance is fine, but I am saying that I think a lot of people don't remember or weren't playing Monster Hunter World on PC when it launched, because even back then it was a very demanding game. If you wanted to play it like 1440p at a pretty locked 60 FPS, you needed top of the line hardware at the time. And that was both you needed a 1080 Ti and you needed a very recent, powerful CPU.
And especially if you were using the higher edge texture pack at the time.
Yeah, well, the high-res texture pack didn't even come out at launch. It was like later, I think.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah, yeah. but
everything about World was staggered launches all over the place.
Yeah. And again, not saying that the performance with Wilds is good. I'm just saying that I feel like I've seen some people say, man, but World ran perfectly at launch. And it's like, no, it didn't. In fact, there was people that complained because like Iceborne added in some new graphical features to deal with like snow and stuff and some updated lighting. And it had the updated renderer. And so a lot of people that had no problems with base game Monster Hunter World had some issues with Iceborne because of the like changes behind the scenes. So
well, I remember a lot of people kind of taking pot shots at MT Framework because they're like, why? Because, well, they're like, that's an old engine. Why isn't this on RE Engine? And they're like, no, what they managed to squeeze out of that was really impressive, I thought, not really knowing the technical basis behind it.
Yep.
And now, of course, we've got RE Engine, Monster Hunter.
Yep.
Wilds is on RE Engine, right?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So, Yeah, so we have a handful of previews up on the site. James's preview is Monster Hunter Wilds Want You to Live in Its World. And we have a freelancer, Siam Ahmed, who I know is also freelance for, I believe, Tom's Hardware and IGN. Playing a near final version of Monster Hunter Wilds has quelled all of my fears. So basically how the game has quickly polished itself up heading up to release. So we do have both of those previews up on the site. And of course, we'll be talking about the full release in not too long. So by the end of the month, at least by early next month, we'll be playing and giving our full impressions at that time.
This is a minor tangent and not that surprising, but there was an IGN interview about Okami 2, and that game, or Okami the follow-up, it's not 2, 3? Anyways, Okami that one is going to be on RE Engine also. Which again, is not surprising, but like practically every Capcom game is RE Engine now.
Yeah, I think. I think literally every Capcom game is RE Engine now because they're even using it for their most recent like remasters and ports. Like they used it for Ghost Trick, they used it for the most recent Ace Attorney stuff. I do not think they've released games that aren't on RE Engine now. Mm-hmm. But one thing I don't think you mentioned is I also did have a chance to interview Tsujimoto was there, but mostly the interview was with Wilds director Yuya Tokuda. I got a chance to speak with him about some of the inspirations for the changes in Wilds and kind of like balancing the desire to like make a game where it's easy for people to keep playing while also accounting for the fact that you want there to be that depth for people to be able to latch on to. And it's an interesting conversation. Josh, did you read that? Or
I didn't get a chance to read it. What did you want to say about it? Like, you put it up. What was he able to say?
Basically the one thing he made very clear is that they wanted to make it so that the actual like getting into hunts and the process of hunting, they wanted to be streamlined. But everything beyond, like outside of the like core gameplay loop of hunting, they did want to make sure that there was still depth to it. So stuff like obviously the resource like gathering for like say the meals, because you can find different ingredients different ways. Like during that preview when I hunted a Kongalala, you could actually get a specific mushroom that occasionally digs up that if you break it, you'll get like a specific like ingredient that's that mushroom.
Interesting. Yeah.
And stuff like that. But it's definitely kind of like refocusing where that depth is and being like, if you don't want to engage with it, you don't have to, but if you want to min max, you can. It's just not required to get through the main story. And I even asked him like specifically, like with what he was saying there, I asked about like some of the player reception to like end game hunts in World, like Lunastra and Latreon, how those were very specifically hunts where you kind of had to have specific skills or specific loadouts to deal with them. With Lunastra, you wanted to have win resistance, because otherwise you would basically not be able to fight her. And obviously Alatreon's like, well, you want to have a non-elemental or a blast or an ailment build? Sorry, we don't do that here. You very specifically need to have a specific element when you're fighting Alatreon, which I liked. Because I think that, but I do know that a lot of people were considerably less happy with that.
It definitely is like, you need to have like a good vision for a build per monster at the end game.
Yeah, and he outright said that they don't want players to be able to use the same set for every single monster, especially at end game for like end game hunts, post game updates. He explicitly said, we didn't want to make it so if you had a certain set, you could just breeze through any endgame fight. It's not the gameplay we want players to have for endgame hunts. We want there to be a distinctive difference compared to hunting story monsters. Basically making it clear that you can probably expect stuff like that to continue with endgame and postgame wild stuff, because that is explicitly the sorts of things that they want to do, which I'm happy with.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the compelling part of that, the end game loop, is you're building an equipment set to fight this monster that's like clearly going to be tough, and it's end game focused.
Yeah,
I think
that's one thing World struggled with.
Yeah, but having clear end game goals, I think, is a part of the charm of the Monster Hunter end game loop in general. Is like, hey, it stops fucking around after you're done with the story. You're gonna have to like think about your preparations now for real this time.
Yeah, you know? and he made it very clear that that's like intentional. They want to make it easy to get to end game. And then once you get to end game, that's when they stop like playing around. So
yeah, I'm really just to see like how Wild's end game shapes up and what sort of updates that fast forward a bit. Like they already showcased like at the beginning of the recent state of play, like their first title update is they're gonna have Mizutsune added. I don't know if they gave a date
Mizutsune you first on Rise? That's where I know him her from.
No, Mizutsune was one of the four flagships that were added with Monster Hunter Generations.
Is that the bubble thing?
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, bubble dragon. The bubble. Yes.
Yeah,
you know where I know Mizutsune from?
Where?
Monster Hunter Stories.
Yeah.
Man, I will say though, it's like we've had obviously what I originally played Generations when it came out in Japanese, so I sometimes forget. It's Glavinus. Yeah, it's Glavinus. So Glavinus was an Iceborne. We got
You're thinking about the rest of the Faded Four?
Yeah, we got Astalos in Sunbreak, and we had like Mizutsune and like I think Base Game Rise, right?
Yeah, Base Game Rise. Yep.
Yeah.
Where's Gamif?
Oh, please! I really want the Faded Four in Wilds. I need all the Faded Four to be in the single entry again.
I'm a little bit worried because I did during the preview get a chance to fight on an ice map, and I don't think there's necessarily a good spot for a giant mammoth type monster. So
Gamith is such a dumb fight. I need Gamith again.
I remember playing like Generations for the first time as Aerial like a greatsword. It's like, man, I just keep doing the same thing because it's this giant stupid mammoth.
Yeah, so think about Gamith for people don't know. Gamith is like it's a gigantic mammoth that like does like its whole model cannot fit in your screen, and when you're attacking away at it, you don't even know what you're hitting at that point because there's just so much skin and fat like surrounding your character on screen. There's like, I don't know, I'm hitting it. I don't know what I'm hitting. It's doing something, but you know, because just the mass of it is just like filling up your entire screen, and you're
and it's like, jokes aside, it's like it is a shame with Gamif, and I do think they could retool it a bit because I think the other like three like members of that group are actually all really good fights.
Yeah, Gamith is definitely the least mechanically interesting because the other members of the Faded Four have like their specific mechanics, like Mizutsune with the bubbles, Astalos with the lightning, and Glavinus with the fire tail.
I'm going to be one of those people really quick. I know that Astalos is the English name. He's always going to be Rise X for me. That is such a better name.
I have to remember it's Astalos.
Hey, I get why they changed Glavinus' name, and I completely understand. And I I understand why they changed Mizu's name, because it was a bit of a mouthful, but it's like, I still think it's like, you could have kept it as Ryzex. That's cool, but whatever. Yeah, but, that's just me being a boomer.
We'll see what the... So they've scheduled the first title update for spring. So it's Mizutsune, and then they said additional updates that they haven't detailed. And then the next title update will be sometime in summer with another additional monster that they haven't identified, along with more event quests. So
yep.
We'll get more info shortly on that. You know, I always like when Mizutsune is in a game, because like it's usually a really fun fight, and the armor sets for Mizutsune are always really cool. Yep, they look really cool.
I might play this as my first like legit Monster Hunter game.
Oh, okay,
maybe.
Wow. You should.
A friend was like convincing me to play it, but his explanation on what this game is very poor. I asked him, it's like, what is this? It's Dark Souls. But not Dark Souls.
No,
the giant monsters. I'm like, what?
It's not. No.
No. I'm like, this is the worst description. And he's like, it's not when, Dark Souls.
It's Dark Souls. Dark Souls.
When people make fun of everything being compared to Souls, that's what they're going at.
Like, no, like, okay, it's like, once you make your big hit, you're committed. You can't go back. You're screwed.
Oh yeah, so, that's unique to Dark Souls. That's, you know, Dark Souls invented that. Yep.
That's so funny.
And I say that as someone who came to Monster Hunter relatively late. That's
why I say, like, the explanation is so poor, but, you know, maybe I'll give this a try to play with him, I guess.
I mean, why not? It's just like Dark Souls Chow.
Oh my god, this world, what has it come to?
So, yep, we covered the, obviously, all the previews and the launch trailer and the first, like, roadmap, very kind of a general roadmap for Monster Hunter Wilds. A few other things that kind of came out of the state of play. This is the one that I think we were not expecting to see, but I think there's a decent amount of excitement for it. We finally saw the next Digimon story. It's real. It exists. We actually have
that got leaked in the game.
Did it? I don't follow the leaks. So
it leaked literally less than 24 hours before the state of play. So it seems like the like retailer pages went up a little bit early.
Yeah, but they didn't show any artwork or anything. Like, we just knew that they're gonna announce a Digimon trailer. Like, for people who are actually like keeping up on like say Wario 64, you know.
Yeah, it was really funny when the pages went up and it was like $70, Bamco, what are you smoking? And people finally saw like the actual footage, and it's like, okay, this has a budget. You have fulfilled the social contract. Still not happy, but we'll be quiet.
So to get like the details out of the way, it's called Digimon Story Time Stranger. It's launching sometime this year for PS5, Xbox Series, and PC.
Probably Switch 2 as well, but we don't.
Yeah, we don't know yet.
It is Media Vision.
Yes, it is Media Vision, and we did like get a somewhat of a teaser like years ago at some Digimon Con event. Where they were talking about, we're working on the next Digimon story game, and it'll involve like the Olympus something.
I think about a year ago, the previous Digimon producer, who's no longer there, basically said, you know, the Digimon story team is in good hands. So like, we knew that there was a game in development. So here it is.
Yeah.
Yep. It looks really good. I should probably finally get around to actually playing Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth and Hacker's Memory. Did you know that there's actually a fan translation re-edit for both of those games, but only specifically the Vita versions?
Okay, I didn't know that, but I'm not surprised, because the original English script for those was like Bandai Namco was not in a good place.
I didn't realize that the English localizations on those were considered like poor.
Oh, but yeah.
It was Vita era, I guess.
It was like within a year of that infamous
Sword Art Online?
Yeah, Sword Art Online game.
And so, Tales of Hearts R is around the same time, and that's translation cycle.
It's like Bamco's gotten a lot better. Well, they've gotten better in recent years, but there was definitely a couple of years there where their translations were. And I'd say that, like, at the time, Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth was probably the best case for that, where it was, like, it was dry, there was, like, some, like, stilted lines, but you could tell that they at least put, like, there was any sort of quality control there. And I usually feel like that would be a bit mean, but then you look at the Sword Art Online game that came out at the same time, and it's like, no, that's just, that's just stating a fact. There was no quality control of that.
Was that the penetrations meme?
Yes.
Yeah, just the penetrations. Yeah. And that was meant to be like a mission or something, but they kept calling it penetration.
Right.
Yeah. But anyways, yeah. I should probably get around to playing those games. I might actually play it on Vita because of that fan translation patch.
Yeah, I'll report back if you do. That's a really interesting project. This new one is like the Cyber Sleuth games, turn-based combat system. It seems to be like you're going through like different, not only in different like worlds, but different like times as well, like as indicated by the title. You have like this, I don't know if they've named like the two main characters yet, but they have like some sort of like outfit uniform with like a white and light and teal aesthetic. I mean, they haven't really revealed too much about like, hey, how does this game exactly work? But obviously, like Cyber Sleuth and the Digimon story games, you'll have like Digimon party that you can raise up and, you know, go through their Digivolutions and have them follow you around as you're traversing through dungeons. It looks really slick, you know. I really hope that I hope this hits in a way that like that the Cyber Sleuth games didn't, because I didn't really get into the Cyber Sleuth games. I think the Hacker's Memory was a little bit better, but they were kind of too easy and they were just very mechanically simple.
Wow. I actually Site Stafford Jr. was actually playing through Cyber Sleuth recently, and I was following him, his playthrough. He was like, you know, Blue Sky posting about it, and he actually dropped it. He's like, I'm not feeling it.
Yeah. I don't blame people for not really feeling it, because it's like it's very basic, and the underlying story, especially in the first Cyber Sleuth game, wasn't really all that interesting either. So I hope this one kind of makes big improvements in that department.
This game is also dual audio, which more recent ones have only been Japanese voices. So
having this,
I will say one thing: did we get full confirmation it was dubbed? Because I remember the original Cyber Sleuth trailer was actually dubbed, and then the game itself wasn't.
Yes, I we have seen that before, where a trailer is dubbed, but it's just for like promotion, not the actual game. But the according to the Steam page, it says full audio English.
Okay, that's good. That's good. I assume, but it's like I figured needed to.
That is a good clarification. Yeah, I forgot that they do that.
Yeah, there's been a few of those, but I definitely remember there were Cyber Sleuth trailers that were English, like English voices, or narration at least. But no, those games were Japanese voice only. And I think like Digimon Survive, did that have voices at all? Did it? I don't remember.
I think so.
Just Japanese though.
I don't remember. Oh god. I played like two or three playthroughs of that game, and I don't remember.
There was also Digimon World, that Digimon World game. Oh,
the re-release of the old Digimon World.
Well, both of them. Like that one had English voices and Japanese, but the story games didn't. Digimon World Next Order.
That
was more of like a builder sort of game, kind of different. But anyways, my general point is, this game seems to have a pretty high budget relative to previous Digimon games. They're going dual audio, you know, multi-platform, Steam release. Unlike the previous games, that kind of had these like staggered, like Vita, then PlayStation, then PC, then Switch. Like this is like kind of seems to be pretty coordinated.
I really hope this is a really cool and great game, man, because like Digimon is such a cool concept, but like just recent, like I haven't really latched onto one like in many years. I really like Digimon because I used to like the old show, and I watched like seasons 1, 2, and 3. Man, Digimon fucking awesome. It's kind of better than Pokemon, to be honest. I was one of those kids.
I was part of that gang.
but I was also like, but then I got to Yu-Gi-Oh. I'm like, man, it's kind of better than like.
So I was not into Yu-Gi-Oh. I just thought those kids were losers.
What the fuck?
I was in that group, sorry.
Yu-Gi-Oh is so cool, dude. Holy shit.
But, I don't know, in my school, they confiscated, like, Yu-Gi-Oh cards because kids were using it as, like, a gambling ring.
I can see that. Fuck.
Did you truly have a public education if people weren't gambling with trading cards on the playground? That was was like a near universal experience.
Everyone knew that one dude that had the holographic Charizard cards. Like your parents.
I definitely know someone that had that.
Uh-huh. You motherfucker.
They're worth a fortune nowadays if that was legit.
I remember the card shop at the mall. Behind the glass, it's like, here's $100 for this single Pokemon card, this holographic Charizard card.
This isn't here or there, but it's weird how like Pokemon cards are still like there's, you see crazy stuff about like new Pokemon cards at Costco and people just like rushing in to like buy pallets of them. Like, Jesus Christ.
And like stores had to have like a enforce a limit, or and I know I even see some stores that have like some stores I've seen have like a separate like machine dedicated for Pokemon cards because they don't want to deal with it. So like you interface only with that machine, they don't stock it, only that machine, separate machine.
Yeah.
It's crazy, man. Fuck.
Apparently there's been a resurgence of that too. It's like it never really stopped with Pokemon cards.
Yeah.
That fight in Costco.
Also at the State of Play, I believe this is at the State of Play, the Lives of P DLC?
Yes.
Okay. I did not actually get to watch the State of Play myself. So I see all the headlines, but just making sure I'm sourcing them from the right place. So Adam, yeah, I know you played Lives of P a lot, and I associate it with you. I know others have played it, not me, but I'll let you take the reins here about what you saw in the announcement of Lives of P Overture DLC that's slated to release this summer.
So the trailer is a little bit hard to parse, like what exactly is going on. But they describe it as like, so in this world, like there's this sort of like phenomenon that happens where like the puppets take over. And in the main game, this is kind of like history. Like you're waking up in this world that's already like controlled by puppets. But this DLC is like saying that it's going to kind of explain the origins of that. But I don't think it's like a flashback or, you know, like a prequel.
Like a prologue DLC.
But it's something like your character somehow is going to like a new location, or like it's showing a lot of like snow locations, which is definitely, there are no like snow locations in the original game. At least not that I remember. It's been a couple of years. But like, I'm not exactly sure like where this falls in the timeline necessarily. And depending on what ending you get, like can't follow the ending. So I'm not exactly sure how it fits in the game, but it's supposed to explain like some lore background, like here's what happened to this world with more detail. And
Adam, I have a question.
Okay.
When I saw this trailer, I'm like, why does your main character have so many anime moves now? The moves look so over the top now. You have like a fire arrow, and then like at the very end, you have like almost like a DMC Virgil style like judgment slash maneuver or judgment.
Oh yeah,
maneuver.
It seems very. When I get to play this, like, do I remember how to play this? I guess that's true for any DLC, but it is pretty fast paced relative. But
yeah, but I don't remember the base game having this like I guess the average flashiness of moves, right? I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Like in this one, this like the moves, the maneuvers they show in this one, like they're all very flashy. I'm like, I don't remember the game, the base game ever having like this level of flashiness compared to like what they showed in the trailer. But it's cool. I mean, I'm down for it. But
it's a good game.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I believe you. I need to get around to a full playthrough myself.
Mm-hmm.
Through it. It looked like a sequel at first when they showed it, and then they showed it as a DLC. I was like,
well, we know the sequel would be Lies of D.
Lies,
well, it can't
Dorothy.
Be Lies anymore because it's Dorothy.
But yeah, that's
who knows. Like, Dorothy's thing is lying,
saying, right?
Though, so I don't know.
It would be Pinocchio.
Truth of D. There you go.
Where I had D on the Dreamcast.
And Adam, I'll let you take point on describing this one, launching this summer for PlayStation and Nintendo, Calamity Angel's Special Delivery from Idea Factory and Compile
Heart. This is an Idea Factory game or a Compile Heart game. This game itself is like, the premise is you're like a delivery team, like mail carriers, basically. Only, not only are you delivering mail, but you also have to like fight through enemies and like other mail carriers. I don't know how that works. It's like this sort of turn-based kind of, it's definitely like a low budget kind of cartoony side scroller. It's turn-based, like side vantage point kind of game, not high budget at all. It seems like kind of more experimental. Not from a brand or franchise or anything. Compile Heart, so it's the Neptunia developers. You know, I have no idea if this game will be any good. It could be a piece of junk. I have no idea. The interesting thing about this, though, is that it's releasing this summer. The Japanese version is releasing this summer. They haven't explicitly said if it's like a worldwide release. But yeah. This is sort of like new territory for Idea Factory, because there's that other game from Compile Heart Idea Factory, Scarlet something. It's not an RPG. It's like the Returnal. It's like anime Returnal.
Returnal-like.
Yeah. That game is getting like a worldwide release on Steam, like simultaneous, right?
It's coming out on console also in Japan.
Yeah, but only
Steam. But not in the West. Only the PC version of that is worldwide simultaneous.
Yes. But this game is like not out in Japan, coming out in summer this year in both Japan and the West. So basically my whole point here is Idea Factory starting at least making baby steps to like releasing worldwide releases? Like, they're a small publisher. You know, all the big publishers are doing this already, but, you know, the small publishers are kind of catching up. So,
yeah, I mean, hopefully it works out for them. I think it's always been kind of frustrating, because you know this, Adam, like whenever Idea Factory wants to say port Neptunia to the West, it's like it's coming to Switch this month. It's coming to Xbox like 3 months later, and we're gonna have a separate, you know, press release just for that, you know, and the first press release of that will be like a window, and then like a week later we'll have the date for you, and it's like, oh, stop this! This is annoying.
Yeah, that's kind of a pet peeve of mine when they kind of announce it's coming out in spring, it's coming out in April, actually it's coming out in May. We have a release date. It's June 1st. It's like, come on. Anyways,
it's like someone like mentions, like, I don't know, someone thinks of a date. It's like, oh, we should make that a press release. And it's like, and then the next day I change my mind. It's going to be actually next month. It's like, okay, wait, that's a press release. It's like, okay, great.
And Adam, sorry to be the low hanging fruit in this podcast, but this next one I also might need some help with.
I think Josh knows more about this than I do. I do remember this game.
Let me try to detail it as best as I can. In like 2022, Blackjack Studio was going to work with Square Enix to make a Front Mission game called Front Mission Borderscape. They ended up parting ways, but Blackjack Studios held onto the IP. And now that game is Mekarashi globally, but also known as Metal Storm, which released in the Japanese market last year. So the news this week is that Mekarashi, the global version of Metal Storm that used to be called Front Mission Borderscape, will be having a global release for Android, iOS, and PC at some point. As far as I can tell, this is the announcement of just that it is planning to release globally. We don't have a window. It's just the announcement of the intent to do that.
That's pretty good. No, he puzzled it together as he was like, he was like unsure. He's like, well, you know, he's like fitting puzzle pieces into a little, it's like this and this. It's like he mostly, you know,
I remember the Front Mission Borderscape, and then I, like, I don't know, early last year, or maybe late 2023, I was like, whatever happened to that? Like, oh, it's something else entirely now. And then I just forgot about it, and now here it is.
It was a really weird like thing, because like as you said, Brian, like the Blackjack Studio had this Square Enix partnership with Front Mission, and something happened internally where one of them, probably Square Enix, pulled out, and then Blackjack Studio probably like, okay, we have like a game here already that we made, so instead of like putting the Front Mission IP on it, let's just make it all original, like just having different names for everything and maybe changing up some of the designs. That's not really Wanzers or anything. So that game turned out to be called Metal Storm, and that released first in China in 2023, then came out late last year in October in Japan, as you said, for also iOS and Android, and I think PC as well in Japan. But as you said, now in the West, it'll get released sometime this year. Just officially, it'll support, you know, English along with other languages, including, you know, French, Italian, German, Latin American, Spanish, Brazilian, Portuguese, Thai, simplified Chinese. It's kind of, I don't know, it's kind of interesting. It'll also be coming to Steam, but we already said it's going to be a free-to-play game, so it'll have, like, you know, in-game purchases. It does have a gacha. I did play a little bit of the Japanese release late last year through an emulator just to see what it was. And it seems like, you know, if you like mecha strategy RPGs like Front Mission style, it does It's basically that. It does have like the body parts of the mechs that you can individually target. So like if you damage an arm and destroy it, they can't use the weapon that that arm equipped. If you destroy their legs, their mobility is totally, you know, shot. So they can't move. They can only move like one space. So it seems to be like a very competently made mecha strategy RPG. But obviously the big barrier, as always, is it's a free-to-play game. It's going to be monetized like a free-to-play game. I don't know exactly how valuable like the gacha units are and like how powerful they are ended up being, because they only tried it out for a little bit. But you know, if when it comes out on Steam and in the West, I'll definitely put more time into it and see, you know, hopefully have fun with it, because I'm always down for a mecha strategy RPG. But it does pain me that at the moment all the big traditional mecha, like anime mecha strategy RPG franchises have all just, you know, they're now free to play mobile oriented first games. Like Super Robot Wars has a DD in Japan, mobile only. G Generation is coming to mobile devices, of G Generation Eternal. So that's now that, and then now you have this weird thing, Mekarashi, where it used to be associated with Front Mission, and now it's like it basically has the bones of Front Mission and all but name. Also, just a free-to-play, you know. Mobile first does have a PC client as well, or PC release. I'm just like, where's the actual big budget home console PC native mecha strategy RPGs? Anyone? I'm looking around, doing that fucking GIF. Anyone?
You'll get Relayer 2.
I'll take it. If it's fucking better, I'll take it. Let's go.
Watch Square Enix announce a surprise Front Mission 5 remaster.
Oh god, I would die. They would never
do that. I would love that. What's that Polish group making those remasters? Remakes? It's not Frontier, it's...
Oh god, what was it? No, man. I forgot.
Would you even trust those guys at this point?
No.
I the machine translate the game and just call it a day.
I don't remember now, but maybe
it's forever. It's Forever Entertainment.
Forever Entertainment. I knew it was harder than that.
Yeah. They're still working on Front Mission 3 remake.
And we're still waiting for are we still waiting for a PC release of Front Mission 2, or is that already out?
That's out.
Okay. I don't trust Forever Entertainment. I gave them many chances.
I don't think anyone really trusts them after they did the Donkey Kong thing, right?
Did they? I don't know. I was only I only remember them from the Panzer Dragoon and Front Mission.
They did the new HD version, which people have been complaining about.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh really? I didn't know they were even associated with that. What's the issues with the new Donkey Kong?
A lot of stuff, like load times, a lot of missing graphical effects that were on both the original Wii and the 3DS version. Some like actual like gameplay issues with like the bounce. It's not good. It's not good.
Forever Entertainment.
I'm surprised that usually Nintendo's on top of their shit with that. I'm still surprised they just let that go through.
Forever Entertainment's like, give us $2 and they'll do it. Nintendo's like, interesting proposition you've made.
That kind of covers us for major news. Just some minor updates for some upcoming games. This one, 100 Line Defense, The 100 Line Last Defense Academy. The last time we talked about this was in like January when they did their first set of character trailers. They've basically revealed additional character trailers and also that there will be a prologue demo for this game. The game's releasing in April on the 24th. The demo will be available on Steam February 18th. And the game will also be available on Switch. I don't know if the demo has been stated to be available on Switch. I only see that it's Steam.
I think it's only on Steam because usually the Steam Fest stuff is just like all exclusive on Steam.
And the demo will carry over into the full game. So We also got a new set of trailers, again, kind of a similar theme, character trailer for the upcoming May release of Rune Factory Guardians of Azuma. So we had an initial trailer for the main characters, Subaru and Kaguya, and then this trailer is focused all around a little bit of Subaru and Kaguya because they are romance options for the other protagonists, as well as all the other romance candidates in the game. So this is just talking about who you can partner up with, regardless of which one you play.
May 30th has become a very busy day for video games.
Yeah, May 30th. I'll definitely check this game out for sure.
You have this new Rune Factory, you have Elden Ring, and then now you have Lost Soul Aside as well. I think that was really that was the state of play.
I was like, my friends call it Chinese FF15.
I mean, the original creator of the game was like, FF15 looks cool. I'm making my own FF15. And that's how Lost Soul Aside came to be. That was the original vision of the game. So, yeah.
And then at the very end of the most recent trailer, it's like, man, it's been so long since this game's been in development that there's stuff that's like, man, that's kind of like FF16 now, too.
Props to the development team. Like, I know first started with a sole creator, then eventually got the resources for a whole ass development team. But like, they've worked on it for many, many, many years, and I wish for the best for that game.
I hope it's good.
Looks cool. Yeah, you have to give props to Sony because they've supported that game through thick and thin, I imagine, for many, many years.
Yeah, and the fact that it's I'll probably play it since it's like day one on PC.
Yeah, there's lots of like projects on like Kickstarters like that got backed by publishers, and then because they were not making any results like within like 2 years, they just pulled the project and you don't see it coming at all, right? Yeah. So there are projects like that, right?
And the China Hero Project isn't just for China now. Like, I think Sony's been expanding that initiative to other regions as well, too.
Was that the Phantom Blade count as that one or not really?
I don't know if that's the China Hero Project. I don't know. I don't think it is.
That's actually like my most hyped game for this year now.
It does look pretty cool. I'm very interested in that as well. There's a lot of like really promising like action games. Like they showed off that Tides of Annihilation thing at State of Play, and that looks like a really cool action game. You know, Chaos Legion, man. It reminded me.
Awesome. Chaos Legion. It's like, man, that's so old from Capcom.
I know. It deserves a re-release. Goddammit. Here's my 3,000-page feature article. Why Chaos Legion deserves another chance.
No, you had to buy Onimusha first.
I will. Dude, that new Onimusha trailer, oh my god, that looks so sick. Miyamoto Musashi as a Titus? I'm down. You got me again, Capcom. They keep... I keep falling for it. God damn it. They show cool games. I'm like... Oh,
it can't be a real Musashi game unless he trolls Kojiro at the seaside.
We'll see.
We do have one sales update. Dynasty Warriors Origins, of course, we talked about this, I think, 2 or 3 weeks ago, has hit the 1 million sales mark.
Yeah.
Obviously, we talked about how it had a really, really strong showing on like Steam Concurrent, and we don't like to overvalue that but it's just kind of the one easily available metric that we get early on. But directly from the publisher, they've celebrated hitting the 1 million milestone, which is really good for, of course, Omega Force and really good for Dynasty Warriors.
Don't forget that Yinja drop with the, what is it, the Warriors Abyss, the roguelike.
I don't know how I feel about that one.
I was watching my friend play it. He was like playing Lubu, and it was just like, oh, this is like an asset slop. It's just like throwing a bunch of like Dynasty Warrior 8 to 9 assets at this mega game.
That doesn't necessarily make for a bad game. The Warriors Orochi series basically has like, leftover assets that mix and match like a lot of franchises together. Those are really good games. Like the Warriors Orochi series is amazing. People can shit about like the asset reuse of those games all they want, but they're really, really fun games. So that doesn't necessarily bother me. But like I just don't have time to try check out Warriors Abyss. But for Dynasty Warriors Origins, I think them releasing that demo before this game came out really helped. Like they also mentioned that the demo for Dynasty Warriors Origins surpassed over 2 million downloads, and a lot of people came away really impressed with positive impressions from that demo, and that momentum enthusiasm didn't stop at the full game. Like people really enjoyed that full game. So This is the power of like just releasing a damn good demo. You know, it'll help
more
you
like
out.
Release a demo before the game comes out, not after it comes out. Like Rise of the Road.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. A lot of
games or Veilguard, right?
Yeah, Veilguard has done that. There's been other games too that's done that. FF16, I think. No, that had a demo before.
Yeah, that had a demo before. And that demo actually got me to buy the game. And yeah. Then I bought it, and I'm like, it's like, the demo's the best part, basically.
But yeah, that's, I think, you know, Omega Force and Koei Tecmo are like, well, we should probably make another one of these things and complete the Three Kingdoms story. That's the right move. So, congrats to them. I'm very happy that somehow Dynasty Warriors rebounded and is like on top of the world right now. That's awesome.
And as usual, we will kind of wrap up the podcast with some dates. We did talk about a couple of them that were announced, Lost Soul Aside and Night Rain, May 30th for both of those. The next major update for Honkai Star Rail would be February 26th.
Does Chao play this one or... I get him mixed up. Does he play this one or does he?
I was gonna avoid the question, but
okay.
He doesn't play Zenless. I know he doesn't play.
I don't
Zenless.
Play Zenless. I don't play Genshin anymore. But I still play this a little bit. Not like hardcore. I feel the game is kind of going this downhill slope, which might not sure if they could recover from.
One of these days, Chao will be optimistic about a game that he plays.
But yeah, apparently this patch, I'm not really positive. They're like it feels like what is it? They're just taking like fan like whiplash and just like trying to like band-aid all these fixes like immediately. It's like, oh, people don't like too much story. Let's just simplify the story or cut it down. Or oh, people don't like having too many puzzles trying to get from the level. Let's delete all the puzzles. It feels like a overreaction trying to
reactionary rather than like trying to like fix core issues. It just
That's how I see like this patch update. Right?
They might have like telemetry that says that the people that are loudest and complain about this are also the people spending the most money, in which case
maybe it's
probably true. Like the biggest weakness of the storytelling in this is like there's too much black screens. I'm not sure you're familiar with the black screen concept in this game, but when you first play it, like every time when there's like a big exposition dump, it'll be like a black screen, it'll be white text, it's like you did and so and did this, and then it did too much of those kind of moments and people were sick and tired of it, right?
Okay,
so I don't know, like maybe maybe it's might get some big fixes in 3.2, but this patch is like I'm not really interested in it. It's more like I feel
based
like
on based on like the one key art for this update at the end, it looks like the new character is like not Fate Gilgamesh.
He's actually introduced in the previous patch. He was okay. Like this guy that's just kind of like a hard ass. He's just like a douche trying to act all tough, but he actually likes to have a competition kind of with you. Like he likes strong people kind of type.
Oh,
right?
Fate Gilgamesh, but not.
I guess.
Got it. Interesting concept of a character for a game that's still scheduled to have a Fate Stay Night like collab this summer.
Like, well, maybe that Fate collab will bring it back to its hype moments again. I don't know.
I'm never gonna come back to this game, even for the Fate collab. They can have it. It's okay. I'm waiting for my fucking Fate Extra remake. That's what I'm waiting for.
Speaking of Fate, sorry. Fate Reawakened. These are
my favorite
Fate series. Every single time we have news on these ones. These are four isometric, like mid-2000s era action RPGs. Were announced for a PC remaster last year. Then they announced that they're going to be coming out on consoles in addition to PC. Now we have a release date, Fate Reawakened, followed by Undiscovered Realms, Traitored Soul, and Cursed King. Will be available remastered on March 12th for consoles and PC. Though the original versions of those games are already available on Steam. So on Steam, you'll be able to get original or remastered, and then consoles will get remastered as well in March.
That's right. People say, they miss when RPGs used to be good, so now's for time for them to put where the money where their mouth is.
Fantasy Life, The Girl Who Steals Time, will be launching on May 21st for all consoles, basically, Xbox Series, PlayStation 4 and 5, and Steam. And Switch.
Dude, I'm actually really interested in this game now, to be honest.
I'm curious because this is the This is a concept game. This is like Inafune Studio.
I know that's the thing, but like the trailer is like really good for the features. Like
that all sounds really nice. The one thing there was actually a thread kind of about this on Reset Era that I kind of agree with the premise, where somebody said, I just saw this most recent details about this, and they said, oh, it's every time you enter a dungeon, it's different. It's like, I'm sure there's some people out there that are really happy with that. I agree with that OP. I do not usually like that. I prefer like bespoke dungeons. So I'm not. I'll probably play this, but it's still like I kind of wish it was.
Yeah. I'm just really interested in like the how customizable like the terraforming is. Like you can like the terraform you get on a giant mysterious robot and just like terraform the land, create rivers, create whatever sort of like unique terrain that you have, and just having this on platforms that can actually like have an awesome high frame rate is good. You know, and just like Megaton Musashi Wired, the level 5 is doing cross play and cross save between all platforms for this, which is how is level 5 the fucking leading developer on doing this shit?
Didn't they technically do that with Megaton Musashi as well?
They did it with Megaton, and they're gonna do the Inazuma 11 as well. They're doing it for fucking all their titles, basically. So yes, they're making the standard between their titles. How are they the only ones doing this? Ah,
yeah.
God damn. I don't know. I want to believe that this game is gonna be awesome and good. I mean, I enjoyed Megaton Musashi, but that doesn't necessarily mean this one's gonna be good. But I've never really played a Fantasy Life. I'd known of it, but I never really got into one. I'm familiar with it. And I really want to play with friends, you know? Like, some friends that are thinking, maybe we should get into this game. One of them really likes Fantasy Life.
We were just talking about how late May is getting busy, and here's another one.
So ironically enough, I think the timing for this is just right, where just if they...
Just ahead of Rune Factory and Elden Ring and Lost Soul aside.
It's also cool that they're exporting Xbox for this as well. I mean, that's usually not something that you really see these days out of Japanese developers, but it's cool when they
Atelier is coming to Xbox now too.
I think mainly of Bandai Namco
has a level 5 game been on Xbox. Like, was White Knight Chronicles on Xbox? No.
Megaton Musashi wasn't on Xbox either.
Is this the first level 5 game on Xbox? Like, I'm trying to think.
Man, they like, all beat Square to the race of putting FF16 or FF7 remake on Xbox.
I don't think Inazuma 11 is what was scheduled for or was coming to Xbox either.
Let me see. Level 5.
We're like thinking now, like, wait a minute.
Was Snack World on Xbox? No.
I am looking at their list of games they've released, and this is their first game for Xbox.
There we go. The sudden realization. I was like, oh my god, this is their first Xbox game. That's sick.
Interesting. I do wonder why they specifically chose Xbox for Fantasy Life. Did they get a Game Pass deal, like a delayed Game Pass deal or something?
Oh, no,
maybe they have faith in the product. I mean, there's some games I buy that is on Xbox rather than PlayStation.
Yeah,
from Japanese developer.
Sure. Why not? You know, the more the merrier. Especially when it has crossplay and cross save.
I used to play Bullet
Hell. Who knows? Like the president of Gust is a huge like Halo fanboy. Maybe that means that they put extra focus on the Xbox version. And that's going to be better than the PlayStation.
There we go. for telling you.
I was gonna say I used to play Bullet Hell games on Xbox 360, and everyone keep asking, "It's like why are these games on PlayStation?" It's like they're a Japanese developer, and I think the reasoning is like it's cheaper and easier to develop for the Xbox, and that was it, right?
Yeah. So, man, May is already looking packed. Yeah. Like, we're still a few months off, and May is already looking like, oh, there's too many fucking games.
I guess technically, Ni No Kuni 2 is on Xbox now, isn't it?
Oh yeah, yeah.
But that was. I don't think it was ported by them. I think it was ported by
Yeah.
What's April looking like for games? I'm thinking of May.
April is like empty, right?
No, they got
Claire Obscure is there.
Oh yeah.
What yeah. April Fool's joke that you'll like to see that becomes a real game?
Usually, like, Game Informer had the really good list. So I'm looking at GameSpot. Says the there's Rusty Rabbit on April 17th.
Oh shit! I want to play that game too.
There's a Fatal Fury on April 21st. There's Claire Obscure on April 24th. Mm-hmm. So there is a decent amount. South of Midnight is on April 8th. I did not even realize that was releasing so soon. Microsoft, get better at marketing your fucking games.
Oh, there's also a 100 Line, and that Yatcha Legend of the Demon Blade game is also April.
Mm. Yeah, but we're always going to have a busy year no matter what. Nice.
Also in May, this is for Japan market, but East Memoir Memories of Celceta, it'll be releasing on Nintendo Switch in Japan on May 22nd. Of course, we just got the global release of East Memoir Oath and Thelgana here in the West. So they're also going to take the same tact for the Celceta game. Adam, wasn't this game like all but announced? Yeah.
It was announced. It was basically like announced at a recent financial thing for Falcom. They did mention that they were porting Celceta to Switch. They did say that. So it was announced then.
I kind of consider that like a soft announcement. Like it didn't have like a page on their website. It was like not on any of their socials anywhere, but they basically said it at the shareholder meeting. Yeah, we're making this. So it's like, okay, it's announced. But it's kind of weird though. Is that like, okay, East Felgana Memoir, or East Memoir Oath and Felgana, which just came out in English like a month ago, that is basically more or less a port of Oath and Felgana to Switch and PlayStation with like the new artwork, new, like, it had like a couple of accessibility things. It had like a turbo mode, it had and things like that.
And but the voices too, right?
Oh, and like some new voices, I think, just for Adol. But anyways, this East Memoir for Celceta, it's a little bit less features. It's just a port of Oath and Thelgana with like some music rearrangements, and that's about it.
I'm sorry, I just need to mention something.
Or Celceta with music rearrangements. Yeah.
I completely forgot that this game's also releasing on like May 29th, May 30th. Fuga 3 is also releasing there. Oh my god, CyberConnect 2, delay it. Delay it.
Jeez.
You gotta pick your priorities, James. You gotta prove to the world that you're the biggest Fuga fan on the world.
I'll play it on May 29th. Nobody else will.
Hey, I will. I played the other games on launch.
There we go, two. We have at least two Fuga heads. Day one, Strongest Warriors.
Oh my god, the end of May is a fucking bloodbath for RPGs.
So yeah, that's East Memoir. It's sort of weird title. East Memoir Memories of Celceta.
Wouldn't the Japanese version be East Memoir like Foliage Ocean of Celceta?
That's true, because Memories of Celceta is specifically the localized word name when it was Foliage Ocean, like when directly translated or something like that.
I assume Foliage Ocean is like just kind of poetic, description of a forest in Japanese.
Yeah, this is interesting. So the logo for this this port on Switch, per like Falcom's own website, is East Memoir in Celceta, and then it's the official name is East Memoir Foliage Ocean Celceta. It's like what?
The what? Huh?
Okay. I'll show you exactly what I mean. This is so funny. It's like, what? But you see what I mean?
Oh, dude. Oh. What? Okay. Okay. That's
so. James has done is given us the Japanese logo for the title card, basically. Yeah, the East Memoir in Celceta, and then the original title in Japanese. So neat. Well, it's coming out in May in Japan, which means we'll probably see it in a year or so in English. But yeah, not doesn't really have as much going for it. I mean, obviously it's nice to make it available on Switch, but doesn't have like the new art that like Felgana did. We talked in late May already about Fuga 3, Night Rain, and Lost Soul Aside. This next announcement, I believe we were expecting, but we got it finally nailed down. Stellar Blade, we knew it was coming to PC. It'll be launching on PC on Steam in June. Alongside the PC release, Stellar Blade's already done a few of these collaborations. They'll be doing another collab with Goddess of Victory, Nikkei. I'm not actually sure how that's pronounced. Nikkei. So I know we have a few fans of the Nikkei mobile game on the site.
Does it count as a collab if it's the same like developer?
It's like a FF14 collabing with FF16. It's like thank you for collabing with us, Yoshi P. Thank you, Yoshi P, for collabing.
It'll be like the Obama meme where he's heading metal to Obama, right?
So they're collabing with Nikkei because it's from the same company, Shift Up, so it's very easy to just say, hey, do you want to collab? Thumbs up, and then there you go.
There are people that don't even know that they're from the same publishers or same developers. It'll be like Maximilian Dude is like, Nikkei, huh? It's like, oh, what? He doesn't know that they're made by the same publishers, right?
Nice. Stellar Blade's had a previous collab with Nier Automata, obviously, because Stellar Blade was inspired in the first place by that game. This one will have like costumes based on Nikkei characters Alice, Scarlet, Anis, and Modernia. I don't know if there's actually like I think there's new stages as well as part of the collaboration. Just new content to play through. There's like a free update coming to the console, and then when it comes to PC, it will also be there. When the PC version comes out for Stellar Blade, I believe the Nier Automata stuff should be there, I think. I'm interested to finally play this. I was just waiting for the PC version.
Yeah, I think this game is solid. Like, like mechanically, I think like Lies of P has like better like systems in general, but as a game, I think it's a really fun like starter kind of soul
game. Right? That's generally the universal reception that I get from friends and you and other people. It's like it's just a really solid, fun action game. Like you know that like it's not going to be getting like perfect scores. Like you know if people are to rate it, but like they're like it's a very solid 8 out of 10 game, which is the consensus around it. And like that's totally fine. You know as long as the game is enjoyable, I don't care what the numerical score is. Just tell me that it's fun and that I'll like it. I'm like, all right, I'll give it a shot. I mean, I played a demo for this too when it came out on PS5. I was like, hey, this is a pretty cool game.
And then last bit of news, further stout date, Borderlands 4, of course, was announced late 2024. We'll be releasing on September 23rd for Sony, Xbox, and PC consoles and platforms.
This is kind of cursed because this game comes out a day after my birthday, and I don't want Borderlands to be associated anywhere near my birthday.
I'm very curious how this game turns out because, like, I've been following a bunch of the people that are like writing on this, and they're like very clearly trying to take it in a like it take it back more to like Borderlands 1 style writing. It feels like. Mm. So I'm curious. Yeah, I
don't know. Like, this might be just a death pack game between me and my friends. We don't know yet. We're not thinking about it.
I just know that there was like one writer specifically said that like what's the quote about if there's a gun that's called the Hawk 2A in this game, I'm going to they're going to scream.
I just didn't I did not enjoy Randy Pitchford showing up at the state of play. I was like, man, ugh.
Okay, here's the exact quote. It was from a tweet. I'm not going to say there's no toilets, but if the word skibbity ships in this game under my watch, I'm going to cry real tears. Mm. Paul Tassi joked that we were going to have a gun called Hawk 2A, and a fellow dev asked me if it was real, and I wanted to put my hand down to say grinder.
Oh, God.
No, man. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what to
explain. I saw some people taking this news as, well, we know Grand Theft Auto 6 isn't releasing in September.
Well, honestly, that's true. I mean, like, they're both like massive releases for 2K. They don't. Well, I mean, Take-Two.
You would assume they would not release the same month.
Yeah, I mean, out of all the major AAA like Western publishers, I have the most like trust that Take-Two knows what the fuck they're doing. So I can't see them releasing them at the same time frame. So,
yeah, I. I was trying to remember. I was like, what was I going to say? I was like, oh yeah, I was going to mention that there's a Borderlands movie that came out last year. I almost forgot, even though I just
did. You
remember.
Actually went and watch it?
Hell no,
it was like one of the big box office failures.
Oh Jesus. But I'm just thinking, I'm like, go for it.
I was going to say that seemed, I have not seen it, so everything I've heard from it is secondhand. But like, I don't know why, but there's something. It seems rare that it's like this movie's going to be terrible. I'm sure it's terrible, and then it ends up being terrible. Like, I don't know. Like everything like aligned as it like well, as we thought it was and as it should be. Like that's what it was. I don't know.
But if, just in case it was a success, we'd make a lot of money. But we already expected to lose a lot of money on it. Great, cool. A project well executed, I guess.
And that covers us for all of our news updates. So February remains packed. March remains packed. April isn't empty. There's still plenty in there. And then May is all of a sudden very packed. So no surprises here. So all the major games that we talked about, we have all of our coverage up on the site. So we have the Avowed review. We have the Night Rain previews and the interview that James put up. And then we have, all the other release dates. I know Adam just recently updated his, RPGs of 2025 release date list that's up on the site. Oh, one other thing I'll call out is that Mikhail did his usual Steam Deck and ROG Ally kind of impressions for Avowed is up on the site as well. And Avowed will keep supporting that game with guides as they come out. Next week, I think the main topic will be Yakuza, I believe is the week that for that. And then the week after that.
Yeah, that comes out on Friday, right?
So. Yep.
Of course, as the big release of the Majima Pirate spinoff, Yakuza, the meme, for some reason, Yakuza series shows up with a pirate game. So we'll talk about how they land on that next week. Week after that, of course, we'll be all in on Monster Hunter. And then, the rest of late winter and early spring doesn't slow down for us. So obviously, follow RPG Site on any of the social networks. Just search for RPG Space Site. You should be able to find us. Join our Discord, discord.gg/RPGSite, and join the conversation there. If you like this podcast on whatever podcast service you listen to us through, give us a like, give us a thumbs up, give us a rating. We'd love to see those. And we'll be back next week with another episode of the Tetracast. So until you hear from us next time, stay safe, take care. We'll talk to y'all later.